It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Oh, you're going to like this week's panel. Becky Worley from ABC News is here. Will Harris from the UK. And Rod Pyle sits in, our space expert, because there's so much space news to talk about. But first, we're going to talk about the Twitter whistleblower. We'll also talk about the LastPass hack and whether it's anything you should worry about. Mark Zuckerberg's interview with Joe Rogan, and then a look at Artemis 1 as America returns to the moon. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 890, recorded Sunday, August 28th, 2022. Jail or Olympics? This Week in Tech is brought to you by Policy Genius. If someone relies on your financial support, whether it's a child, a parent, even a business partner, you need life insurance. Head to policygenius.com/twit to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. And by userway.org. Userway is the world's number one accessibility solution, and it's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use is an easy choice to make. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off Userway's AI-powered accessibility solution. And by Wealthfront. Get a bonus $50 when you start investing with Wealthfront. Sign up today. Visit wealthfront.com/twit. And by the new and recently updated TriCaster 2 Elite by Neutek, the most complete live production system on the planet. There's a TriCaster for every production, including yours. Visit go.newtek.com/twit-tv for an interactive guide that can advise you on which TriCaster is right for you. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show we cover the week's tech news. You're going to be very happy you tuned in this show today because it's OG Twit time. Becky Worley is here, my dear friend from ages gone by, ABC News technology and consumer correspondent. You see her all the time on Good Morning America and elsewhere on ABC. Hello, Becky.
Hey, Leo. I was just trying to think. How long have we known each other? 98? So going on 24 years?
That's kind of amazing. Yeah, we first met when you produced both the screensavers and Call for Help at Tech TV's debut. It was ZDTV back then. And you produced Call for Help for most of the show, I think. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And you wrote my recommendation letter to go to grad school.
I had to get rid of her, so we sent her to Stanford. And you always give me credit for that, which is sad because I'm sure it didn't have anything to do with that. But I'm so glad you went. You studied educational technology, right?
Yep. And haven't really used much of
it. Not
at
all. No.
But it was a good experience. It was certainly good to be in that environment. And, you know, I took a ton of computer science classes and human computing interface. And in a way, coming from a liberal arts background, it gave me sort of the deep breath. Yeah, I can hang in this space and I can participate. And I learned a lot about cognition, which is huge when you're trying to communicate in any medium. So in the minute and a half that I get for an ABC GMA story, knowing how to get my message across, that I learned a lot in grad school. So
they make you do some strange things. Last thing I saw, you had all these sensors on you. You were all wired up for what you were going to. Was it sleep testing? What was it?
Yes, I was testing the Aura, Fitbit, and the Samsung Galaxy Watch, how they monitor your sleep and report your REM stages, your deep, how long you slept, how long it took you to fall asleep. And we tested those against a standard sleep study, something you might go do if you have restless leg syndrome or sleep apnea, to see how those mirrored up. And it was super interesting. That's what I love about my job, is that I get access to these incredible tools, facilities, institutions, and can use them to get information about consumer tech that you wouldn't normally get.
Yeah, this is something we always would like to do, but don't have the resources to do it. So how accurate are those devices?
Well, it hasn't aired yet, so I can't give you the full details. But thank you for the tease.
When is that going to be? Is it going to be on this week?
It's going to be on, I think, in October. We've been doing these series about biohacking called The Science of You.
Right.
And I have loved it. And I want to talk a little bit later, if you want to, about continuous glucose monitoring apps.
Oh, and, I'm wearing one. I'm wearing a CGM right now. And you know what's interesting? It was not prescribed by my doctor. It was something I saw on Instagram. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for those. But I am type 2 diabetes, diagnosed a few years ago, and I've been doing finger pricks just every once in a while, and I thought, hey, that's kind of cool if I could continuously monitor this. This is the Abbott product. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it. That's cool. Anyway, yeah, it's great to see
right
Becky.
Here, so we'll talk about it.
Becky's always here when I'm not here. She's our preferred fill-in host. So it's nice to have us both in the same room at the same time. People were starting to suspect that perhaps we were the same person.
But same.
Yeah, now we know. Also with us, hey, I haven't seen Will Harris in a long time. He's got a new job. Every time I see Will, he's got a new job. Hi, Will. Welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be with you. It's a fabulous Sunday evening here. I always love doing Twit. Obviously, we kick off about sort of
it's middle of the night.
PM
over
here in London.
Yeah.
So tomorrow is a national holiday, so I get to stay in bed in the morning.
Oh.
So, you know, we can go for however long, you know, it's all good.
What day is tomorrow?
Monday, Leo.
Is that a national holiday now? I think that's a great idea.
We have like a national holiday for the end of summer. It officially is like, you know, when the misery begins.
Is it like St. Stephen's Midsummer Day or something like that? I mean, what's the
name? I mean, something like that.
Okay.
I like that you're translating, Will, and calling it a national holiday and not a bank holiday.
You know, I know my audience. But yeah, as Leo said, I think every time I come on, not quite every time I come on. But it's lovely to be here. I have a fantastic new gig at unbound.com.
This is really cool.
Really interesting books.
Oh, this is so cool. So you're a publisher, and the books are very nerdy, very interesting, and crowdfunded.
So the kind of idea is that, like, whereas most publishers, you know, they publish quite mainstream stuff because you need to be able to guarantee the return that you'll get and guarantee that you're going to get it into Barnes & Noble, we are able to do much more interesting and some slightly geeky things because we crowdfund the first printing of all the books that we do. So we've got some fantastic books around the making of the Resident Evil series, the making of Alien Isolation, which I think most people consider to be the scariest video game ever made.
The Gothic Cookbook.
The Gothic Cookbook, if you're feeling a little bit miserable, but also kind of kitchen-esque.
But this is the one our audience is going to be most interested in. Douglas Adams, who passed away some years ago, creator of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We didn't expect any new Douglas Adams books, but there is one.
Yeah, so we worked with the Douglas Adams estate. So we have a book called 42, and it's all the kind of stuff that was left lying around Douglas Adams's office when he died.
Oh, Lord.
So there are post-it notes.
This is my worst nightmare.
Unpublished kind of memos, some wedding speeches, papers that he had kind of kicking around. So we collated a sort of, each page is a facsimile of something interesting from his office. Scripts, jokes, speeches, to-do lists, poems.
Oh, Douglas
Adams.
It's
kind of the last.
Would flip
yeah,
over
Douglas
this.
Adams fans, it's the last kind of trove of material from him. So we have that coming out. You can pre-order it now and get it, get supporter editions the beginning of next year.
I just want to say, if you do this after my death and you find the Bitcoin password, I would really appreciate it if you would not publish that until my estate got a hold of it. Okay, just saying. This looks cool. You are offering our audience an offer code. I just wanted to mention this up front.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You're very kind. If anybody wants to go and grab a book, if they want to grab 42 or the Resident Evil or Alien books, TWIT15 will get you 15% off any pledge at the checkout. So go and stick that in and enjoy some nice books.
Thank you. Unbound.com. Every time you're here, you have a different job, but they're always great, right? You're always doing some very interesting things. This seems like a really interesting a company to work for, unbound.com. And look who the cat drug in. A third host, Rod, made it.
Meow.
Rod, you're sunburned from the North Pole.
Yeah, well, the sun doesn't set there.
Rod Pyle, he is a regular on our show, a radio show, The Tech Guy, a space reporter. He's the host of This Week in Space, our program with Tarek Malik, who is the editor-in-chief at space.com. Rod is the editor-in-chief at Ad Astra, which is the national publication of the, it is the publication of the National Space Society, NSS.org, written a great many books. I'll bring the pile in. I'll have the pile brought in
the pile
for
pile.
Later in the show.
Okay, that's fair.
But the pile, we call it. You just came back from a month on Mars.
That's what I called it, yeah. And it was extraordinary.
You're up in the Arctic Circle, right?
Yeah, so we were up at about 15 degrees, or 75 degrees. Yeah. Sorry, it's 15 degrees south of the pole, which sounds like it's a fair distance away, but the sun never set. It kind of skirted the horizon, which, as I was mentioning to you earlier, for a photographer, you got sunset for 3-4 hours a night.
And NASA goes up there because it's like Mars.
Yeah, so it's so close. I mean, there's no perchlorate. The soil isn't oxidizing like Mars, but it's gritty.
it will kill you instantly, is what you're saying.
Not like Mars, yeah, but it's cold all the time. The soil's very sharp and gritty, gets into everything. So it's a great place to test hardware. So
look at this.
Spacesuits.
This is Mars-like, I guess. Because there's no animals or anything. And you guys are riding, instead of rovers, you're riding little Kawasaki ATVs.
Yeah, because they had two rovers up there, but they kept getting bogged down in the soft soil and so forth.
Oh,
so Pascal Lee, who runs this in conjunction with NASA. He's got a doctorate in planetary geology, works down at Ames and the SETI Institute, is a big advocate of using some kind of alternative ATV on Mars.
Nice.
The idea being the astronaut would have some of their life support on the ATV. So when you sat in the ATV, you'd have your spacesuit plugged in. And when you got off, it kind of followed you everywhere you go. So that's why they experiment with
the ATVs. They were testing that.
Yeah.
And here's the gang up where the sun never... Says the guy on the right, John Shute, looks like he actually lives up there.
He's an amazing guy. He's crested 4 of the highest mountains on the planet. He's done 34 seasons in the Antarctic.
Yeah, it looks like
as an expedition leader finding meteorites. And he's this regular. If you didn't ask him about it, you'd figure he's just some guy living on a bus stop,
Yeah.
But you start talking to him, and he's astonishing.
What fun!
Yeah.
Anyway, really, Rod is here because there's a lot of space to talk about, including tomorrow's big. Well, at hoped big launch.
Crossing
our fingers. Anyway, what a great panel. Rod Pyle, meet Will Harris, Becky Worley. Welcome to all three of you. I guess we'll kick off. There's so many stories we could start with. I think we should kick off with the Twitter whistleblower, Mudge, who worked briefly for a year and a half for Twitter.
Banging on 2 years.
Almost 2 years. Peter Zatko. He was very well known. He was one of the members of the Cult of the Dead Cow hacker group, testified to Congress as one of the members there about hacking. He was at Loft, L-O-P-H-T, very well-known hacking group. Later on, worked for the Department of Defense and other very respectable organizations in cybersecurity, was hired by Twitter right after they were hacked. Remember when Elon Musk and Barack Obama and Tim Cook, rather, accounts were hacked, saying, "Hey, we want to give back. So if you give us some crypto, we will double it and give it back to you." Like any idiot would fall for that. But it was a massive hack of some of the best known accounts on Twitter. Twitter freaked out, hired Zatko. He was there almost 2 years, fired at the beginning of the year, according to Agrawal. After he did the whistleblowing, he said, well, he was fired because he wasn't any good. He says that Twitter's security is terrible. He said he tried for a long time to tell him. They didn't listen. So 6 months after his firing, he became a whistleblower, sending information to the FTC the SEC and others. Lots of stories have come out of that. I have to say, as soon as I read it, I said, I want to know more before I believe everything he says.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Becky.
Because I was reading this and something that's, you know, I was curious, what exactly are the allegations that are being made around the security breaches and problems? And so he said there were no logs, and he specifically called out around January 6th.
Yes.
That there were no logs, and then nobody knew where the data lived, whether it was critical. All engineers had some form of critical access to the production environment. And if an internal engineer wanted to take over the platform, they could, and they wouldn't know where the attack was coming from, and there was no way to close that down. Is that something that you think most companies do have? I mean,
well, maybe. I mean, here's the irony of this. That was what he was hired to fix.
This is exactly it, Leo. So you've got it nail on the head. So he comes in 2020 in order to fix, you know,
exactly that.
We can probably all appreciate is a lot of Twitter security problems, right? As you pointed out, the hacking of Tim Cook, all the cybersecurity stuff. He then makes a big stink about the fact that following January the 6th, you know, he was worried that somebody who was sympathetic to the January 6th, you know, quote unquote insurrection cause could take over the platform and do something. And you're like, well, dude, you've been there for a year and a half. Isn't that what you were supposed to be doing?
He was literally brought in.
Did you work that out a year and a half ago? That was your job.
So, I mean, really, his complaint might be, well, I tried and they wouldn't let me. I don't know if he said that specifically. He also said,
I think what he says is that a lot of the complaints that he had and a lot of the queries that he had
were ignored.
Basically got tied up in the kind of Twitter executive board, which was non-functioning because of the Dorsey.
We knew this, though. Twitter's had the most dysfunctional board in history.
Right?
Yeah, that is Twitter in a nutshell. That's our little dysfunctional friend. He said that Twitter was in violation of its FTC consent decree. In 2011, the FTC, after a number of security problems, said you must establish and maintain a comprehensive information security program that will be assessed by an outside auditor. And you must not, this is the best part, you must not lie to your users about your security. And he says, well, they didn't do either. Again, he was there. It's hard to know. I mean, Mudge is respectable and respected. So, you know, there is some concern that maybe the timing of this so close to Elon Musk's trial in Chancery Court in October, in Delaware, that maybe it was to support Elon's contention that there were too many bots on Twitter. Actually, there's a very good piece, which I recommend, from our good friend Mike Masnick on Tech Dirt, in which he explains why the whistleblower report actually does not support Musk, even though it might seem to. It supports Twitter.
So I think, I mean, there is, I don't want to get too meta about this, but Becky will know, as somebody who works in a media outlet. I don't know Mike, and I don't know TechDirt very well, but it's very interesting to see like what outlets run with what version of that story. And you can kind of guess like who got the internal briefing from the Twitter PR, who got the internal briefing from the PR that Mudge clearly hired, because the different angles on this story are like really distinct. This guy was fighting his hardest to try and fix a broken culture within Twitter, or it's this guy was absolutely, you know, an idiot who couldn't, you know, tie his shoelaces together and certainly couldn't fix anything, you know, inside a major corporation. And you go, well, those two things, you know, two perspectives on possibly the same set of facts. But it's interesting to see who runs with what.
I will defend Mike on this. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, I didn't understand the story. Will you explain why I still don't understand why it supports Twitter.
So that's because you're in the media. Okay.
Hey. The lamestream media is not telling the truth.
Masnick says the media is unfortunately falling for the spin. Mm-hmm. So what Masnick explains, and this is God's truth, he's not making something up. revolves around a misunderstanding, intentional or accidental, that Elon has about bots, and then Elon has intentionally confused the world about. It sounds like Elon is saying that the platform is more than 5% fake, and that Twitter has been lying about that. That is, in fact, not what Twitter has ever said. Twitter's counting something called monthly daily active users. And this is not monthly. Sorry. That would make no sense. Monthly daily active users. What is MDAO stand?
Monetizable.
They're even better. Thank you for correcting that. So MDAOs, monetizable daily active users, is a number that Twitter gives its advertisers so that when they buy ads, it's in effect saying, well, every day, this many people who could click on your ad are watching. They also say very clearly, they said this to the SEC, they said it to the FTC, they say it to advertisers. This is an estimate because it's hard to tell who's real and who's not real. We estimate about 5% of that MDAO number, very important, not of the total, but of the MDAO number, could still be bots. We try to filter them out, but we may be off by 5%. That is, they never say how many of all of Twitter is bots. The whole point of calculating MDAO is to tell advertisers, this is how many people could click on your ad, and we might be off by 5%. So Elon is intentionally or unintentionally conflating bots on the total platform with this very important number that Twitter is using. It's the number they use to monetize. And Twitter's always said it exactly right. And in fact, the whistleblower, Mudge, confirms it.
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, I think to say whether Elon is doing it intentionally and unintentionally,
he will look.
Is there that much question?
We don't know
it.
His intent, but it looks like he's trying to get out of the deal, right?
Like, and
so he's looking
it,
whatever
right?
he can find to get out of the deal.
But
right?
I think the more important point, rather than the spam and the bot thing, is kind of a tangent. The question is, you know, did everybody who is basically an engineer at Twitter have access to basically mess with the platform with no logs that described
right,
who messed
bad.
With the platform?
Right.
I mean, that's bad.
That's bad.
If you've got to commit code, if you've got to mess with the platform, that's something that you should put your name to. And he is basically alleging that anybody, half the engineering team could commit anything without having to put their name to it.
Here's why this whole MDAO thing is relevant to that. Because Mudge is misstating this in Elon's favor, showing a misunderstanding of what's going on, which then casts, in my opinion, into doubt the entire whistleblowing account. If he doesn't understand this, we don't know how much of this is accurate, how much of this is he thought supporting Musk. It puts the whole thing in doubt. So I'm not saying it's not true. I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying what we have to do is wait for an investigation. The SEC and the FTC will investigate and see what they come up
with. That'll be pretty
quick,
right? That'll come around pretty quickly, right?
And 10 years, we'll know what happened.
I looked at this from a different perspective, which was follow the money. And so Mudge, in the federal whistleblower policy,
there's a reward.
$10 million is the reward.
Yeah.
But if you look at the SEC filings on top executives at Twitter, they're getting huge amounts of their compensation in stock. So I don't know the exact amounts that he was compensated in stock or how much he currently holds, but you're thinking that he would sabotage his own net worth by undermining the platform. So both of those things could be true. And
so is he going to make more money from the reward than he would lose from the failing stock? We don't know that.
Right.
What we don't know is if Elon Musk made a call and said, hey, you know, it'd really be helpful. I mean, that's really a scurrilous.
That's very conspiratorial.
That's a scurrilous accusation. But I think my point is there's a lot we don't know. And I don't think you can just say, well, Mudge isn't lying. This is true. If it is, it's horrific. It's bad. But there is some areas in this, including the MDAO, where he doesn't understand what's going on. There's also this question of, well, it's that bad. Why didn't you fix it? I mean, that's something he could have fixed. He was in charge of security. He could have said, no, from now on, we got to log access. Simply.
Well, I think the thing that it really comes down to and the thing that it just highlights, and I mean, in a sense, the sad thing about this is that it isn't really news, which is Twitter leadership is just an absolute shoot show. Like, it's terrible. Nobody can, you know, really take responsibility for anything. You know, we are in a situation where the board is trying to force a sale of a company at a stock price that was, you know, 30% lower than it was 9 months ago in order to get out of what seems like a grim situation. Like, this is not a company that's got its head screwed on straight.
No, that's, and so, but we've always, like you said, this is not news.
It's news, but it is sort of crazy that this, you know, Twitter has almost become a utility for a certain section of the internet. Then, and it's kind of mad that it's run so insanely.
This is the real question then for you all as the panel. And I'd love to know what you think, Becky, and I'd love Will, and I'd love Roger weigh on this. How important is Twitter? So what if it's a shoot show? Right? Who cares if it's a shoot show?
So I think answer is it's really important to a certain segment of the population.
Journalists.
But we way overestimate how much of the population that is. It's like 100% of journalists are on Twitter. And so journalists think that 100% of the world is Twitter, right? And I say that as a former journalist. I understand the bubble. How important is it to real life? I mean, what percentage of the U.S. population is on Twitter? Like 7%, 9%, less than?
Yeah, but think about it this way. You know, a lot of people assert that Twitter is the public square, right, of the digital
age. That's my question.
But
is it?
I like the metaphor that it's more the Colosseum. That a lot of people, and this is not my original idea.
This is brilliant.
But that the idea is that there's so much viewership of the blood sport that's taking place on Twitter. And that is important. And it's a proxy for the public square. Now, that's just one thought. Another thing, this question really was front of mind for me also, Leo. So I did a little research and listen to this. The Senate Judiciary Committee's top Republican, Chuck Grassley, said that all of these complaints, the whistleblower complaint, raised serious national security concerns and privacy issues that need to be investigated. And he said, take a tech platform that collects massive amounts of user data, combine it with what appears to be an incredibly weak security infrastructure, and infuse it with foreign state actors with an agenda, and you've got a recipe for disaster. I actually thought that was pretty intelligent.
Except the foreign state actors aren't getting the data that Twitter collects. What data does Twitter collect, really? It's not doesn't collect the same quality of data that Google and Facebook collect, incidentally. I mean, what information do you give it?
You've got to look at the trending topics to know that, right?
Yeah. I mean, what information do you give Twitter? Not much. In fact, they did misuse the information. We know this. When you give them email and phone numbers for two-factor, we found out, and they've pleaded guilty to this, that they would use it for advertising. But that's not a national security issue. Remember, the Republicans don't like Twitter because they banned Donald Trump. And so I think there's a certain amount of piling on from the Republicans because they just don't like Twitter. So let me ask you this, Becky. Do you think Twitter could be used by foreign adversaries as a potent propaganda tool?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I would only just extrapolate in a thought experiment based on the complaint and the whistleblower complaint, which is what would be a scenario where it could have caused more destructive actions, say, during the January 6th insurrection? What if certain accounts were suppressed and others were promoted? Would that have really changed history? I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe it was used to organize, but if it didn't work, they could have gone WhatsApp. They could have gone to Signal. They could have gone to any number of messaging platforms.
Truth Network.
Truth Social apparently is about to go bankrupt, by the way. That's another,
but I think,
that's another matter
I think,
entirely.
Becky, you've hit the nail on the head with the Colosseum thing, right? It's about a group of people wanting, you know, a certain amount of spectacle and enjoying the spectacle. But I think the fact that we're even discussing this, this evening is
a case. We're a tech network.
Look, we're going to discuss it because the quote comes to mind of, you know, Leo, are you not entertained?
Yes. Well, I have heard from many of our most avid fans that they are not entertained by discussions of Twitter. So I am taking a great risk doing this, but I think it's important. My point with Grassley is he's bringing in two separate things: the privacy violations and foreign actors. They're two completely separate. They're not. There's no intersection, even though he's acting as if there's an intersection. I think the private actors thing is reasonable. Nuggets, more nuggets from Worley.
Two nuggets that I think are interesting. The attorney for Mudge is Deborah Katz. And I thought, gosh, I know that name. Yeah. And I looked her up. She represented Christine Blasey Ford in the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah.
And the chief whistleblower in the Harvey Weinstein debacle.
So she's the important whistleblower attorney.
She's a heavy hitter. So yeah. These are not small actors here. So I thought that was super interesting.
Can I ask a macro question?
Rod Pyle, macro questioner.
Rod finally speaks up. So I've missed.
You're just wisely avoiding it because you, for the last month, you've been in the Arctic.
Well, no, I haven't gotten any news because I couldn't listen to you up there. It was horrible. And I mean, literally, the only comms we had were 144 character texts on our GPS units. But that brought me to thinking about Twitter while I was up there because it was a similar character count. And so, stupid macro question, but has anybody figured out what Musk's game plan might have been, just stepping back to the beginning of this crazy story, to almost buy Twitter as opposed to actually be serious about it? I mean, I know there was talk about, well, he was going to do this and then do that and drive the price down and get it for less and all that. But this is a guy who, love him or like him, crazy or not, you know, has been on this kind of crusade, somewhat quixotic in some cases, to build electric cars to save the environment, to build massive, ever larger rockets, he tells us, to set up a backup population on Mars, although I think most of us who don't get to go probably wouldn't be that supportive of that, but we like the idea in theory. You know, for $44 billion, he could have condominiums on the rings of Saturn right now. So what is the point if he's really doing that? Is there some other agenda here? Does he really think that it is such a big chunk of the public conversation that he's going to use that to drive his other agenda? I'm confused.
Can I give the conspiratorial answer from the other side of the pond?
Oh, please, I love conspiracies, and we never flew to the moon, you're going to tell me.
So the conspiracy that we have over here...
There was a guy who used to be on the show who said that, and we don't have him on anymore. Banned him. Go ahead.
Is that Elon obviously has an enormous stake in Tesla, which is, to a greater or lesser degree, heavily dependent on government grants and part of the... you know, if you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, gives a lot of credits to automakers that make electric cars.
It restores Tesla's credits, which he had lost.
Yeah, he has enormous contracts with the Space Agency and NASA, which are government bodies. And all of this is a very long play on the expectation that Donald Trump will win in 2024. And in order to restore access to Donald Trump's Twitter account in 2024... there might be a little quid pro quo to Elon.
Wait a minute. People across the pond think that?
I mean, when it comes to your crazy politics, talk. We'll think about most things.
Is it?
I mean, is it crazy? Is it crazy to think that Elon would barter Donald Trump's Twitter account?
I think there's a simpler Occam's razor here. I think there's a simpler explanation for all of this, that the Elon Musk who bought Tesla and built it. Did he found SpaceX or did he buy it?
He founded SpaceX with a couple other engineers
And built it. Is not the Elon Musk of late that we've seen primarily on Twitter. His latest thing, by the way, is the biggest crisis coming to the world is underpopulation, which is why I have 10 children. He's off his rocker now. He's not the same guy. He's off his rocker. And he's also he's a ready, fire, aim kind of guy who ready, fired, aim $44 billion to buy Twitter and then realized, oh, that was a bad idea and has been trying to get out of it ever since. That's Occam's razor.
I think ready, fire, aim was how he got his 10 kids, wasn't it?
What do you think, Becky?
Yeah, I mean, I think he shoots from the hip. Yeah. And it's worked well for him for a long time. And this, you know, there's times when it doesn't work and you want to back out. And he really got into it and is now in a big legal brouhaha, which is going to take up a lot of his time and energy. And
cost him money because I don't think there's any way the Delaware court doesn't say, well, you got to make Twitter at least a little bit whole. I don't think they're going to make him buy it. But I think that they're going to say more than a billion, more than the $1 billion breakup fee. It's going to cost him several billions. And by the way,
I also think the market changing in the middle of all this offer
didn't help.
I mean, didn't help and might have given him cold feet if he was sort of on the edge. And so maybe,
and if you look at the amount of Tesla stock that
minor.
He's had a sell.
Yeah, the amount of Tesla stock that he sold to try and make that happen, right? And saying, I'm not going to sell any more Tesla stock. And then 2 months later, more Tesla stock.
Well, there is another conspiracy theory on that one. Tesla, as you know, just did a 3-for-1 stock swap. And the thinking was that he was going to sell the stock. There was a tax manipulation, essentially. And then buy it back at a lower cost after the split. So, there's some people who even think that was the play all along. I'm trying to remember who it was. Not Jim Cramer, another stock guru who says, you know, what this really was all about, a Tesla stock and nothing about Twitter, nothing to do with Twitter. So
I thought Elon looked really normal this week at the SpaceX T-Mobile event when he was talking about... satellite coverage and how that's going to...
Let's talk about this, because that's going to be a great story for the next segment, because it ties in with what Apple's about to do a week from Wednesday. Are we done with this Twitter? Yes, we're so done. I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, bottom line on this, interesting whistleblower, fascinating. Going to have to withhold judgment till I see more evidence. The EU is also going to do an investigation. There's investigations galore being launched by this. I personally am going to wait and see. I'm not going to believe or disbelieve. I'm just going to wait and see. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, there's lots of signals pointing in both directions.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to hold your judgment until time plays out.
In about 2028. Alas.
I think he just loves achieving in chaos.
I think he loves attention. I think he's at this point an attention whore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and
it's a very,
know him well.
I mean, anything around Elon is a very high signal to noise ratio, right?
Or
very low. What's the right way? Low signal to noise ratio?
It's one of those. It's either high or low.
What's the right one?
lot of noise,
low signal,
little signal.
High noise.
Yeah, so that's. Depends on your math.
It's low.
You got it.
It's low.
People who know, you started to say, right, people who know Elon.
Well, it seemed to feel that money really has been this sort of late arrival of concerns to him. And, I mean, he was so close to totally winking out when SpaceX was first failing.
Not the first time. He's done that. He's thrown his entire fortune into Tesla, risking the loss of everything. So
and did it again with SpaceX at least two or three times. And if it wasn't for external investment, they'd be done. But, and again, these are just people who know him well. I don't at all. But their feeling is that this concern about money has become kind of a late arrival. This, you know, Emperor Elon thing that we're beginning to see on Twitter is also a bit of a late arrival. And they're confused. So when I ask what they feel, their feeling is he's still not that concerned about it. He's really just concerned about this achievement within chaos kind of lifestyle that he loves.
He's done amazing things. The chopsticks,
he's revolutionized the launch
industry. The chopsticks thing that catches the SpaceX capsule as it's coming back, it catches it, then repositions it on top of the next rocket.
Yeah.
What?
Who
thought that was a good idea? But it works.
You know, he took on these major... Sorry, I'm getting off the space angle again. I can't help it. But he took on these major prime contractors that NASA and especially the Air Force have been working with for decades.
Well, that's what we're going to see tomorrow with Artemis, which is essentially a Boeing launch, not a SpaceX launch. Much delayed, 6 years delayed.
Well, at least depends on how you slice that. You know,
how you start counting.
You could say more like 20 years if you look back to Constellation. But he took on all these contractors and said, I can do it better than you, and I can bring the rockets back and wash them off and empty the ashtrays and launch them again.
And he did.
Because it's just not that hard. So I talked a few years ago to Tory Bruno, who's the CEO of United Launch Alliance, and he said, he cleaned our clock. And we had to go out and figure out how to do this cheaper. And SpaceX now controls over half the world's launch industry, and that includes all the stuff China does. So amazing stuff. He's obviously a genius, but there's a little loose part rattling around.
I think, I've always thought this. If we'd had Twitter for 500 years, we would have known they're all freaking nuts. Edison, nuts. Ford, nuts. These guys are all nuts. We just didn't know it because there was no Twitter. So thank God for
Twitter. Well, the spectrum hadn't been defined yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Are they? Is it a spectrum issue? I don't know what
it is. Elon says so, and certainly for some of the
You know what? That's convenient for Elon. I don't.
Yeah, but if you've ever seen him in person, it wouldn't shock me.
He claims he's on the autistic spectrum.
Yeah, and he does have those kind of little mental pops where it does seem like it, but like I said, I don't know him well, so I can't say.
Yeah. I think all the geniuses are crazy. Laporte, nuts.
Yeah, put me in that.
Hey, he's not an ADD guy, or he wouldn't be here.
I'm definitely ADD.
Yeah. Well, when I coach, and when I coach kids, I often have kids who I look at them and I try and assess who they are and what they're about, and then I imagine their future. And some kids, they're either jail or Olympics. And that's kind of...
And the same kid, though. That's the point, right?
Yeah,
the same kid.
You don't know if that kid is going to jail or going to the Olympics. You have no idea. That's
That's like a great episode title. Jail or Olympics, episode 890.
Yeah.
So that's Elon. He's,
you know what?
He's
that's
Olympics
that's
now.
The definition of genius, maybe. Mm-hmm. Jail or Olympics, right? No, really, seriously. That's the definition.
Or Nobel Prize. I mean, let's, you know, give
the
something
geni- I'm not... The geniuses of the world are a different species. I'm not a, yeah. I'm not. And so I'm just going to putt along, but the genius is to soar to that level. There is this great risk that you will go the other way. And I think that that's actually the most astute thing we've said today, Becky.
Well, it's the Hemingway, Oscar Wilde, Hunter S. Thompson model, right?
Oh, you go over, look at Steve
Jobs.
You've
got to be mad to be a genius.
You can go on and on and on. Look at Attila the Hun. Nice guy. But you really wouldn't want him as
Attila
a neighbor.
He was a nice guy. He was a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. Great cook. He was fun to be with.
What are we eating at that barbecue?
But you wouldn't want to move next door. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I say, you know, just in following up with what you're talking about, I worked at Caltech for a year, so I'd go down to the cafeteria for lunch every day. And you're surrounded by these Nobel Prize-winning, multi-doctorate, brilliant people from all over the country. But the cafeteria is the most dysfunctional logistics nightmare you've ever seen because people literally walk into each other. Lunch is flying everywhere. I mean, I would try and walk with my tray with a sandwich, and you'd sort of carve this path between people that are staring over your right shoulder, never in your eye, over your right shoulder and walking right towards you like you can't be there. You're not allowed in that same dimension they're in or something. It wasn't arrogance. It was just personality
traits. You have to be a rule breaker if you're going to achieve to that. I mean, clearly,
but these weren't rules they were breaking. This was just their condition.
This was just their condition.
It was. They were on, and it was really cool to be around those
people.
They
were on the ATH spectrum, the Attila the Hun spectrum. Yeah, I think we've got a new one. All right.
Eating long pork for lunch. Okay.
Oof. Nice guy, but you wouldn't want to go to the barbecue. I agree. I know what you're saying. We do have to take a break. We will come back, and then we will talk about whatever that thing was about 5 minutes ago you said we should talk about. But we're going to get to that.
You bet.
As soon as somebody remembers.
T-Mobile in space.
Thank you.
I'm doing it.
Thank you.
I'm here for you. I'm still your producer.
You're still my producer. Move your mouth.
Remember your mouth. Yes.
We're doing Call for Help. I've told this so many times, so I apologize if you heard it. We're doing Call for Help. I have Becky in my ear, which is the best thing in the world is to have Becky Worley in the control room. And she's the producer. She's the line producer. She's in your ear. And she says, move your mouth. And I thought she said, move your mouth. She meant my mouse pointer was on something on the screen. She meant move your mouse. But I, like an idiot, start going like this.
That was the control and how wonderfully collaborative.
Whatever you say,
for an audio medium.
Whatever you say.
Mouse.
There's a fine line between mouth and mouse. I'm just saying, like there is between
could get you in real trouble.
The Olympics and jail. Our show today brought to you by Policy Genius. Now this is true genius here. We pay hundreds of dollars a year for insurance to protect our homes, our cars, our phones. What are you doing to protect your family? Right? My phone's insured. My family? Wait a minute. What? Mortgage payments, schools, colleges. Those kind of debts don't disappear if something happens to you. A life insurance policy is the best way, the only way to protect your loved ones with a financial cushion they can use to cover those costs. And I know no one wants to think about the worst case scenario, but let me tell you, it's important for peace of mind. It's the first thing I did when the kids were born. I said, you know what? Responsible. I have to get life insurance. And I still have it, which probably I could stop now, but I think it was a very important thing to do. We also have insurance on me for the company. We have what they call key man insurance, right? Having life insurance through your job, which I always had, probably not enough. Maybe enough, you know, to buy a nice urn, but that's about it. Most people need about 10 times more coverage than their job provides to properly provide for your families. Now, I got to tell you, life insurance gets more expensive as you age. I'm glad I got it in my 30s. You always want to get the policy sooner than later. Here's the way to do it. I wish this had been around when I was getting my policy. Policy Genius. It's not an insurer, it's an insurance marketplace, okay? So that's what you want. You want to make it easy to compare quotes from top companies, but the big ones, AIG, Prudential, but you want to do it in one place to find the lowest price on life insurance. By comparing quotes with Policy Genius, you can save 50% or more on life insurance. That's the market is very inefficient. And so the cost of life insurance for you could vary 50%, even more, right? You can go to Policy Genius, get a policy for, say, let's say $500,000 in coverage. That's probably what you'd want to start with, as little as $17 a month. Isn't it your family worth that? Click the link on the show page or go to policygenius.com/twit. You can get personalized quotes in minutes. No obligation, no cost. Find the right policy for your needs. In order to advise you on this and help you with this, the people at Policy Genius have to be licensed agents. That doesn't mean they're selling you their life insurance, but they have to be licensed agents to advise you. So they're working for, I want to make this really clear, they're working for you. They are not employees of insurance companies. They're on hand for the whole process so that you have somebody trusted. You can ask, well, what's this mean? What is it? What should I do? They want you to understand your options so you can make decisions with confidence. And they're not paid by the insurance companies. Policy Genius does not add on extra fees. They don't sell your info to third parties. I know we're all very sensitive about that these days. Just check, Google or Trustpilot and look at the reviews. Thousands of 5-star reviews. People use it. They love it. You can get coverage in as little as a week. If you want, you can avoid unnecessary medical exams. You know, just it depends. But you can go there and say, that's one of the things I'm looking for. Since 2014, Policy Genius has helped, get this, over 30 million people shop for insurance. They've placed $150 billion in coverage with the biggest insurance companies, the best insurance companies. They do, of course, have home, auto, disability, renters. They have all the insurance. So anytime you need insurance, policygenius.com/twit. But I wanted to really emphasize the life insurance because that's something I think a lot of people forget about. Go to policygenius.com/twit. Get your free life insurance quotes. See how much you could save. Thank you, Policy Genius, for supporting the show. We appreciate it. And you support the show. And I always say this, but please take it seriously when you go to that special address, because that they're looking for that to see if you saw it here. Policygenius.com/twit. I'm going to get to your story, but I'm going to do it in a circuitous fashion, Becky Worley.
Okay.
Because the Apple event is, I didn't get an invitation. The invitations went out. Are you going to go, Becky? Do you get to go to?
I'm not sure. I got the invitation to stream, but
oh yeah, but that doesn't count.
May
Everybody
or may not.
But
see, yeah. I think we get one invitation for ABC, so
yeah.
That's my story. They're talking about sending me. I'm not sure.
Everybody in Northern California gets one invitation, and I'm not on that list. No.
No. Well, you and I were both banned. I'm just.
Were
happy
you banned?
Yes, because of Twit.
Oh, this is when you accosted Steve Jobs.
He came to me.
Okay.
For the record.
Tell us what happened.
I was live streaming to you from the event, from the magic room where you get to touch all the goodies.
The demo room, yes.
Yeah. And I was just showing everything that was there and I was live streaming. And then I had one of those headsets on.
Let's run the tape. here we go. Turn up my sound. Do you have my sound? All right. I don't know why I'm plugging into the phone. I guess that's the only way I could. Where's?
So this is from my phone, and I'm just looking at everything. And then Steve walked over, and he walked up to me and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm live streaming, and we're looking at all the great gadgets. And then I asked him a question that he didn't like. And then his lady handler got real. That's her. And
yeah.
Katie.
Yeah.
She got real unhappy with me.
Pushed you away. And, you asked him, when are you going to open FaceTime? You promised FaceTime would be open source, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Why and am I not getting sound? What's going on? It's on my end, he says. I don't think it's on my end. Would you please check?
So he didn't like that question very much, and Katie.
He's look at his face. Oh, yeah, he's grumpy.
Video conferencing?
Oh, wait a minute. Let me go back. I magically fixed the sound.
It fits in the bag, and you take it with you everywhere.
Okay, here's Becky accosting the greatest man who ever lived.
You like it a lot?
A lot.
Fits in the bag, and you take it with you everywhere?
You don't even need a bag. 2.3 pounds.
Can I ask you one other question? Does the fact that we now have FaceTime just on the Mac mean we won't see APIs for other video conferencing?
We didn't say any such thing.
Okay, just checking.
We didn't say any such thing.
Yeah, he did.
There you go.
No, he did.
That's a first on Twit Live.
And so you haven't been invited back since then, huh?
A couple years. Once Katie left.
Did Katie Cotton ever at any point say, "Do you know Leo Laporte"?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Just check.
I didn't rat you out, dude. I'm just saying.
I love just the mild casual sexism of like, can you put this in a bag? And it's like, no, you don't even need a bag. You can put it in your pocket. And it's like, how many dresses have pockets?
Come on, man.
This is the major complaint of all the women in my life. None of my dresses have pockets. What are you doing?
A purse, of course.
I think in hindsight, I like the fact that we were talking about like, oh, it's so light and casual. Can you put it in the pocket? Hey, are those APIs coming out?
Yeah, we're about FaceTime. Open source.
You're a sandbagger. You are so good. You are so good.
Thank you
for doing that. I have such respect for you, Becky. That was
a debacle. It was.
Do you know what's amazing about that clip is, man, that is an old ass iPhone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why we're playing it off an iPhone. I don't know what was going on there. But anyway,
But the new Apple event is going out. It's happening September the 7th.
September 7th. And yes, the invite has this. The Alka-Seltzer Apple, I call it. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what an iPhone it is. The tag is far out. Which means me think this is supposed to be space. These are galaxies, right? This is
the Apple looks like stars in a galaxy.
Yeah. So that makes me think about the rumors from a couple of years ago that the iPhone would have satellite connectivity, which then leads me to the story you were referring to, because weirdly, just this week, T-Mobile and SpaceX announced there would be satellite connectivity for T-Mobile subscribers coming next year.
Through what? What system?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Starlink.
Yeah. Now, I don't understand. They say you don't need anything special in your phone.
They said a piece of T-Mobile's like mid-band 2.5 gigahertz spectrum and a clear view of the sky is all you need. And that it will use the existing hardware that's already in your phone.
Well, Iridium.
Because that 2.5 gigahertz
like
spectrum has been like just
that's
kicking around like, for ages. That was the slightly lame spectrum that people had to give up for 5G.
I'm confused.
They said you'll be able to text, send images, and if there aren't that many people in your area, you'll possibly be able to do video. And specifically said, works with existing cell phones.
Yeah. I'm gathering, and certainly the Apple solution is intended for areas where there's no coverage, but you need it. It's an emergency. It's like a spot phone, right? Mm-hmm. But that didn't sound like what T-Mobile.
No, the Apple one was exclusively an SOS communication.
Right.
Was the rumor. But the T-Mobile one is, they said it'll be free for premium or mid-range accounts. Low-cost accounts probably won't have it.
And Musk said it's meant to provide basic coverage to areas that are completely dead.
Hawaii, Alaska, this is one of the ocean parts.
Ocean Park?
Yeah, this is one of those ocean things parts. Where it's like, it feels like... I don't want to say like it's almost too localized to be an Apple event, but it's like Europe doesn't have that problem. Right. There aren't places in Europe really where you can go where you can't get good cell coverage.
There are places in Transylvania where you cannot get cell coverage.
It feels like a very American thing. I have an alternative theory.
This is news to me. I did not realize that only in America you lose cell phone coverage.
Anywhere in England, you're going to get decent 4G.
Interesting.
You know, that's what happens when you get Brexit. You know, you just, Brexit happens and you get the amazing coverage.
All right. Okay.
What about if it's a camera that has like a space mode? Because everyone wants to take proper photos.
You're talking about the Apple.
Get good ones.
Yeah, that was the other speculation, is that these are astrophotography.
That was
stars.
My first hit on
that'd
it.
That'd be cool, right?
Like something you might get off the web, and that you could then make the allusion to. Well, and they're selling all these great. If you look at Celestron now, they're really amping on the
Pixel
iPhone.
This is my Pixel 6, which has excellent astrophotography.
Yeah, but there's a lot.
Came
more
out a year ago.
They've sold 7 of those since it came out.
Yeah, but I'm one of them. So
there you go. That's important.
No, but they're really that's very Apple, though, isn't it? And now for the first time, astrophotography on a phone.
Well, yeah, because those 7 people that bought that phone don't count. It's you're going to bring space photography to the mainstream.
Okay.
We're going to make space photography accessible to people for the first time. You can come up with all sorts of Apple blurb. It'll be called, face space. Face space.
Snapple.
And there'll be an open API for it for everyone else.
Thank God.
So is that the panel's,
or it just
consensus
looked cool?
That this is... Or just look
because it's the web decade now.
On MacBreak Weekly, we often say the designers at Apple are just laughing their ass off when they see all the speculation from media.
Yeah. Oh, this must mean satellite phones.
No, it's just a good picture.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a tie into Artemis. Maybe the timing's close to the launch. Who knows?
Yeah, or JWST.
Yeah, that just looks like moon dust. That's kind of weird looking, isn't it? It looks scruffy if it's supposed to be Artemis. But I do buy the web thing, maybe.
I'm looking at it, and it does look a little bit like James Webb Galaxy. See, there's some on the side there. They're diamond, cat eye.
But then what's inside?
Nothing.
That's gravitational lensing, and that's the power.
Oh! Yeah. Are they going to use gravitational lensing for...
For the web? They did for that first picture.
Use it for the web. I know.
Can you do that on the iPhone? Crummy little home telescope? That I doubt. But
okay, so you don't think this is the Alka-Seltzer Apple? Because it could look like that. I mean, I could be that, too.
Well, after paying $800 for a new lid for this computer a month after it went out of warranty, Alka-Seltzer Apple would have been appropriate.
When you were up in the Arctic Circle,
yes, sir.
You had no phone service. You had to use satellite.
Yeah, we had to actually use our GPS units, and the new Garmins have, but it's alphanumeric, so it was like a trip back to 1991. So I was going.
You mean it's T9? You have to
yes.
Oh my
tap,
god!
Tap 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 tap. Oh, I did it backwards. So wait, where's the delete key?
If you want the letter C, you have to tap A.
It wasn't quite that bad, but they basically had a display on mine anyway. Now, supposedly, get this, you can hook it up to your phone, right? Yeah. You can Bluetooth it to your phone.
Yeah.
No, the GPS. The Garmin. So you can then go in on your phone and use that keyboard. So I brought up a Bluetooth keyboard so I could Bluetooth to my phone, which would then Bluetooth to the Garmin. But unfortunately, I got up to the North Pole, effectively, and... got ready to sign everything up or to get going because I had already signed it up when I was down here, and it said, hey, I can't find the domain server.
The domain server?
Wait, why would you have to do that for something that's designed to operate out in the wild?
Domain server?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Really upsetting.
And you called us. We heard from you every week via Iridium, which is a satellite phone service.
Yeah. How many of those are left?
I don't know.
Because our service was abysmal.
So when Iridium launched... It failed pretty. It was Motorola, I feel
like.
I think so. It failed pretty quickly.
And it was like a batch of 16 and then another 16?
There are 66 satellites.
66, okay.
And they're geostationary, I think. They're floating right above you at all times.
Right, but they still kind of bump along the horizon over the day.
Oh, so they're not geostationary.
So we had time of day issues. Now, it could have been weather, but certainly, standing outside under a clear blue sky... they would connect and disconnect and connect.
Here's a bit of history. The Iridium Communications Service launched in 1998. Becky, we know that year very well. Mm-hmm. The first Iridium call was made by Vice President Al Gore to the great-grandson of Alexander Graham Bell, Gilbert Grosvenor, who was the chairman of the National Geographic Society. Motorola, yeah, provided the technology. But I remember, yeah, 9 months after the launch, they went into bankruptcy.
Wow.
The handsets could not operate as promoted until the entire constellation of satellites was in place. And that was going to cost so much money that they just folded, which, of course, means nobody bought. It was one of those catch-22s, which means nobody bought the phones, which means they couldn't do anything more. Apparently, it was also fairly mismanaged. But eventually, in fact, in 2000, Motorola said, we're going to have to deorbit these. We're going to have to bring them back.
They did, yeah.
No, they remain in orbit and operational. The government, the U.S. government, as opposed to the Queen, stepped in to save Iridium by providing $72 million in exchange for a two-year contract. I'm reading from Wikipedia. And approving the fire sale of the company. That erased $4 billion in debt. It was restarted in 2001 by the new Iridium Satellite LLC, owned by a group of private investors. So that's why you could use that. They replaced the original constellation they sent 75 new satellites up on, SpaceX Falcon 9 rockets. Again, Elon Musk.
Yeah.
All roads lead to Elon.
Well, I love this concept. I really hope it succeeds, and I hope Apple brings it into their technology. This could save so many lives. I think about all the people who are...
James Kim, our dear, dear James Kim.
First thought was James Kim, who got lost in the Oregon mountains, trapped in the snow. Nobody could find him for 10 days, and he died. And I just think about all the backcountry skiers, anybody who's in nature. You know, there's so many times where you're off the grid and off that coverage. And it's a little nerve-wracking. I'll say, as a mom, I would want my kids to have that on their phones.
You spend a lot of time, you're from Hawaii. You spend a lot of time, I think, stand-up paddleboarding. I don't know, doing stuff in wilderness. You probably would use this, yeah?
Oh, yeah, and I fish a lot. And so, you know, to be out, especially now with the fires, I went fishing on the Tuolumne River this summer with my son, and we went down this really tiny road, one way in, one way out. A week later, the fire started in Yosemite, and we could have been trapped in there like that.
Easy. Yeah.
And so having that kind of access, it's funny because you think about it when I used to, before cell phones, used to never think about this stuff. But now you just, that access to help and first responders is a nice thing to have.
You really get used to it. And you bring up the point of two-way communication because you could get the warning that the fire is closing in on you. Whereas I was just thinking about it with the Garmin. Well, I got an SOS button. That's all I need to do. And somebody mentioned on the chat, by the way, Inmarsat. We had an Inmarsat box as well, and it worked for about an hour a day.
Oh, wow.
And it was because the geosync satellites were down close to the
south
horizon.
Of you. Yeah, because they're used more for marine communications.
You know, we walked up to the mountain, so we'd have a signal. But what's weird is it would be fine for like an hour, and then it would kind of vanish for the rest of the day when the sun didn't go down.
The sad thing on the James Kim story was he was an early user of GPS. And his GPS map led him to a place that he shouldn't have led him to.
It showed a logging road as a true through pass from the Highway 5 to cut over to the coastal route.
A shortcut.
But it was just a logging road that wasn't open in the winter.
So he had his kids with him and his wife, and they were stranded in the car. He went to, they were... I think they were burning their tires to stay warm.
Burned their tires. They had a couple snacks, and she was breastfeeding, and that's how the kids made it. And then after 10 days, James just felt like they weren't going to get found. Snow on the ground, and he went out and
breaks
died
my
of
heart.
Hypothermia. Yeah.
Breaks my heart. Yeah. Yeah. So technology failed him, where let's hope technology could save people going forward.
You know what's going to save people, Leo?
If you say unbound.com
for the camera cutout on the new 14.
That's it. Yeah, the whole punch. Yeah.
I mean, how did you transition after that?
Thank you for that.
Thank you for helping us. As the de facto producer of this show, thank you for that segue. But thank you.
The event rumors are the notch is going. We're going to have an Android-esque camera cutout for the 14.
Yes.
We're going to have a pro watch, which has a 2-inch watch face.
No, 2 inches. 46 millimeters, just 2 millimeters bigger. That's like 2 inches.
I'm all for, you know what? I see lots of friends who have the enormous Rolexes or the enormous kind of, you know, Pateks or whatever.
Sure.
I just want an Apple Watch that's just going to like, you know, obscure my wrist.
How about one you could hang around your neck?
Like
Biggie Smalls.
Like the dude with the Flavor Flav. I want the Flavor Flav Apple Watch. And AirPods Pro to get what is described as a Beats-esque redesign. I don't know what that means.
Beats-esque.
Now, have you talked on this show about why men wear huge watches?
Well, let's ask Flavor Flav.
Especially... Why do they wear it?
Because they're big.
There you go. Yeah.
Men wear watches to show their masculinity. Big watches to show their masculinity. But I always found it odd.
But it's got
to
be big with lots of little dials and tiny numbers that you can't
see. Yeah, but here's the thing. So I can almost exactly tell you this. So as Leo will know from one of my former jobs, as Leo likes to point out, when I worked at Condé Nast, working on GQ and Vogue and that kind of thing,
you're an expert.
Men like big watches because it's the very few, one of the very few things that we get to wear is jewelry.
We don't have any
choices. Women can wear earrings, necklaces, nose piercing, rings, all that kind of thing. Men basically have watches as the only thing that's socially acceptable to wear is
so funny
decoration.
That you're saying this because I had lunch or dinner with Ben Parr, who's been on our shows. Used to be at Mashable. He's a startup guy. And he's not wearing an Apple Watch. He's wearing a Movado, big old Movado. And I said, why aren't you wearing an Apple Watch? You're a geek. He said, because we don't have many chances for accessorizing, and this is it. Or if you're a physician, red noses, colorful ties, and strange socks, there aren't a lot of choices. We all wear a uniform. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the Apple Watch is kind of one of those great democratizers, sort of like the Prius was. You can live in Los Angeles, in West Los Angeles, no less, and drive a Prius and wear crummy jeans and a $500 t-shirt, and people can't figure out how much money you make.
Yeah.
They assume you're loaded. Yeah. The same
Once
thing
they
true
see
the
my
watches.
Nipple ring, they know.
Ow. Ow.
Just kidding.
Let's see.
I stole that from the chat room.
Leo, no.
Wow. But have you ever had a big chronograph?
A big what?
You know, one of those big...
Oh, I thought you were talking about...
No.
Ooh. No. Yes, I've had big watches. But the Apple Watch is pretty... Is a big watch.
No, but I mean like the detailed, you know,
yeah,
it's got the whole planet Earth on it kind of thing.
Things,
And I bought one just because it was on sale. It was on Prime Day. It was a Seiko Cordura or something.
Those are beautiful. I think
they're
cool.
Yeah, but it looked like a Breitling, you know, at a quick glance.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll take that to the events where I have to, you know, try and build up my stubby stature. And I cannot learn how to use the thing. It took me an hour to figure out how to set the time zone.
Yeah.
And now it's got all this other stuff on it. And then, I have to set the time. And I had to get out the instruction book to figure out how to use. And then the second hand doesn't count. It just drives me bats. So I went back to wearing my little Chinese workout watch instead.
My watch is, I'll show you my new watch, which is, I think it might be a little too big. I don't know. I'm just thinking it just might be a little too large. John's bringing it in. I don't even think I could wear this around my neck, actually.
Well, I've never seen one of these that was metal before. They're usually styrene.
Yeah. No, these are nice. This is the real deal.
Wow.
Yeah.
That might be a little big Flavor Flav, Leo.
It's very Wes Anderson, Leo. I can see you holding it and just sort of, you know, you're in the middle of a shot in a Wes Anderson movie.
I've never had a watch you had to roll on its side.
You can roll it out of here. All right, moving right along. Anyway, with the Apple event a week from Wednesday, we will stream it live. Micah Sargent got an invitation, so he will be going down there. Interesting thing about the invitation, it did say the Steve Jobs Theater. So
it's going to be in person, right?
Not only is it in person, it's going to be inside. So the last thing Apple did, WWDC, they did it at the campus, but they did it outside. There's lots of room outside there. The invitation specifically says the Steve Jobs Theater.
Well, it kind of goes along with the Tim Cook 3 days back to work, right? So yeah. Apple's clearly like, yeah, this is it. We're all back to normality, right?
It's over. COVID's over.
But I'm sort of stuck on Micah getting the invite, because surely they know he's the up-and-coming rising star.
Apparently
of the tech
they don't.
Guy.
Don't, I mean, mention that.
Apple.
He doesn't know me. Never met me. Never met the man.
Band's over. You're good to go.
If you know, it's funny because it's Gizmodo got invited back. Becky Worley got invited back. Seems like. Did you do any penance, Becky? Did you kiss the ring or anything?
I have kissed the ring.
You've kissed the ring. No, I don't.
I
don't care because somebody has to. These things. In fact, more and more, I'm thinking these are just big adverts. Why do we cover them like we do?
Well, there was a great article about how tech products are no longer announced. They're dropped.
Yeah.
And yeah, the product drop is now an event, just like an album launching. And yeah, so it's just the opportunity to just bring the hype, basically.
Yeah, and I don't want to be complicit in that. So what we do is we stream it, but we then comment on it and try to give it some ground it in some reality. I don't know. I'm wondering. Go ahead, Will.
Well, I was just going to say, my grandmother, bless her soul, at 98 years old, just once had the insight. She was saying, you know, I was sort of explaining what I was doing, what I was working on, and she said, you know, nothing can ever just appear in a shop these days. It has to be launched. Everything has to have a launch.
I love her.
And my 98-year-old grandmother grasped this idea of everything needs a launch. And I think, you know, whatever Apple's going to do on September the 7th, it will well and truly be launched.
You know what else will be launched? Lieutenant Uhura.
Her ashes gone.
Oh,
that's a segue, right? Nichelle Nichols' ashes.
Wow. Wow. Sure.
I didn't know this. There's a company that does this.
Celestis.
This is their business of taking remains into space.
A sample. So they take just a thimble of you. They don't take your
a little
whole,
bit.
Yeah.
Nichelle Nichols, who recently passed, of course, mm-hmm, Lieutenant Uhura from Star Trek, will be on the next flight. She won't be alone, by the way. She will be accompanied by ashes from Scotty, James Doohan, ashes from Gene Roddenberry, and Gene's wife, Majel Roddenberry. But it's not the first time any of those others have been in space.
I was going to say Scotty already went.
All of them.
That's kind of weird.
All of them.
Okay.
In
so they
fact,
had some leftovers, you're saying.
Well, that's why I think it really is.
Or they had some coffee.
It's like a little tiny bit.
Yeah.
Do they go back to the urn and say, can we have a little bit more? We want, I don't know.
You don't have to ask the urn. You just take it.
Okay.
I've got a couple of those.
The Celestis Voyager Memorial Space Flight, a launch from Cape Canaveral. Is it a SpaceX rocket? I know.
It wasn't. This one might be.
Yeah.
You know, for my money, if I'm going to do something like that, I want to launch a whole bone.
You okay, know, that's
not
creepy.
Not cremated.
Sorry.
No, but there's a reason. So,
why?
So first of all, you get that 2001 moment of the bone drifting in space that Stanley Kubrick did.
Yes.
But then you aim it for reentry so my kid can come out and laugh and clap while my bone burns up and you can watch it. I mean, that'd be much cooler than just the idea that, oh, you know, dad's pinky ashes are in orbit. So I'm
more than orbit, by the way. They will be sent out beyond the Lagrange 2 point where James Webb is.
Oh, so it'll great. So now we're going to have these impacting the James Webb
in space.
More damage on top of what we're
in
have.
Space.
Lieutenant Uhura.
It's powered by United Launch Alliance. I looked it up. Vulcan Centaur.
Okay.
ULI Vulcan. Get it? it will host Gene Roddenberry, Major Barrett Roddenberry, James Doohan. Not their first time up there, according to Vanity Fair.
Right.
The first time Gene and Majel went up into space, am I saying that right? Majel, was when Jim Weatherby secretly took them up in the Space Shuttle Columbia in 1992.
How cool is that?
In 1997, Gene was loaded into a Pegasus XL rocket in the Canary Islands from which ashes were launched, orbited Earth for 5 years before reentering. So we're all, there's a little bit of Gene Roddenberry in all of us now. Yeah. And then through Celestis, Gene and Majel had some of their remains sent up two more times. So this is their fifth time. In 2013, their ashes were joined by Scotty and a strand of hair from Arthur C. Clarke. This time, this company launches DNA as well as ashes.
Yeah. I knew they were moving that direction, so you could just... I would just send up a skin cell, I guess.
There's a great science fiction story that needs to be written here about James Doohan and Nichelle Nichols coming back to Earth because somebody cloned their DNA. We sent it to the aliens. They cloned it and sent it back. Like, I don't know. There seems like a story there. I'll leave that open to you. There is, by the way, a chance to join them. You have to be dead first.
But I was going to freeze my head. Catch. Doesn't that get in the way of doing that whole thing?
Yeah, no, because you could send a pinky. Just freeze the head and send the rest.
Okay.
Reservations are still open. Pricing starts at $12,500. I don't know.
And that's for specs. See, if they were going to launch all of me cremated, we need a Falcon Heavy. So I don't think it's going to happen.
This is so curious. Starting at. What do you think the
bargain price? Well, maybe that's lower in the in the fairing, and you come out last.
The upsell on your ashes?
You can get a memorial service, a launch pad tour. Doesn't really help the ashes much.
A velour ash holder.
Yeah. Maybe? There's Gene and Majel. Hugh Daniel drew a...
I'm really disturbed by the fact that the font on that website is basically the Halo font, which makes it seem very, like...
Wow.
Xbox-ish.
This is going to be... Is that really the Halo font? That's hysterical.
Yeah, it's very, very similar.
Is there a date on this? Because the Vulcan's not flying yet.
Well...
Did they say when?
Launch schedule. Scheduled
delays if
memorial flights, the Aurora flight, the Tranquility flight, the Destiny flight, the Enterprise flight, and the Excelsior flight. Yeah, they're all scheduled. They're all scheduled. Later 2022 for some of these. November 2022. Q4 2023. February 2023.
This reminds
our most popular memorial space flight service.
Really? For all the dozens of people that have done it since 2000 when we started. This reminds me of this very cool service that was coming out of Japan about 3 years ago, 4 years ago maybe, where they were launching, I think it was before I came on your show, they were launching little cans of tungsten ball bearings coated in different chemicals so you could have a bespoke meteor shower. So if you're having a wedding reception, it's outside, it's sunset, this thing's going overhead at that exact moment, and it would have a little explosive charge that would blast all these tungsten balls out, and they'd re-enter in this big plume of different colors.
That's like special fireworks. Almost.
A little expensive.
Yeah.
A little questionable environmentally to some, but I thought it was a really cool idea.
If you want to go up, reservations close August 31st for the Enterprise flight, which will be later this year, or as soon as ULA can get a space launch vehicle up and running.
Yeah.
And they will stream the memorial service and the launch live via webcast.
Okay.
Payment plan is available.
Let's sign right up.
Let's take a little break. Our show today brought to you by userway.org. Userway.org. I'm talking about making your website ADA compliant, accessible. Not only is it the right thing to do, because you're opening up your website to a much larger group, 60 million plus people, you have a responsibility to make your site accessible. It's a public entity, so you got to make it accessible. And with UserWay, it's easy. That was my biggest concern was, oh, I can't afford it or it's going to be too hard. No, UserWay is really affordable and it's really easy. It's AI powered. It tirelessly enforces all the accessibility guidelines, the WCAG, WCAG guidelines. And I love this. So do our engineers. It's one line of JavaScript. That's it. Because UserWay is so good, it's used by more than a million websites, including the big guys, Coca-Cola, Disney, eBay. These are companies that really have to be accessible, and UserWay can do that. As you get bigger, they scale with you. If they can handle Disney, absolutely they can handle you. They make best-in-class, enterprise-level accessibility tools available to you, your small or medium-sized business. And then as you scale, you need UserWay, and you're ready. It just makes business sense. Some of the biggest problems, nav menus, very difficult. So the way this works, if you're blind or you're using accessibility tools, there is what they call an accessibility layer. That's what the screen reader sees. So really what UserWay does is make sure that all the information available to the front page to the sighted user is available to the browser in the accessibility layer. It changes colors. Now, you've got your Pantone color for your business. Of course, we do too. It doesn't change that, but it adjusts hue and luminance so it's easier for people with vision issues to read. So UserWay will generate alt tags. That's one of the reasons it needs AI. It can actually see the picture and generate an alt tag that matches the picture automatically. You can go in if you want. You can modify it, of course. It fixes violations like vague links, fixes broken links, makes sure that your website uses accessible colors, and you'll get a detailed report of all the violations that were fixed on your website so you know exactly what it did. Plus, you can work with it. UserWay integrates seamlessly with your site builder software. Let UserWay help your business meet its compliance goals, improve the experience for your users. UserWay can make any website fully accessible, ADA compliant, and everyone who visits can browse seamlessly, customize it to fit their needs. It's a great way to show your brand's commitment to the millions of people with disabilities. It's the right thing to do. UserWay can make any website fully accessible and ADA compliant. In fact, if you want to see how it works, we've got it running on twit.tv. Just look at the lower right corner. With UserWay, everyone who visits your site can browse seamlessly, customize it to fit their needs. Great way to show your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. Go to userway.org/twit. You'll get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. So book a short call, get their accessibility guide, learn all about it. It really is nice to know you can do the right thing. You can be legally compliant in such an easy and affordable way. UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. Visit userway.org/twit. We got a lot of space news, actually. It's really good you're here, Rod, because there's tons of space news this week. James Webb, how long has the web been up now? It's like a month. It's not long. A couple months?
Yeah, it's been 8 or 9 months since they launched it, but it's only been commissioned for like 6 weeks, eight weeks, something like that. Yeah.
A lot of beautiful images.
So that was gone for almost a month.
Anyway.
So yeah, about 2 months.
2 months.
That's when we did our thing.
Hard to believe that it has already. So one of the things Webb is looking at, by the way, we saw Jupiter, which was cool. So
they can
look back at our solar system. But they found the first exoplanet, non-solar system planet, with carbon dioxide, which is a big deal?
Well, it helps them understand how the planet was formed. And apparently the large part of it is the differential between solids and gases when it's in its accretion
phase. It's not somewhere you'd want to live. It's 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit.
And that's the bummer about these first exoplanet observations and the ones we've been seeing for years is they're all the ones that are a lot of them are Jupiter-sized or larger, and they're practically skimming the surface of the star. Some of these things orbit in hours.
Yeah, this one is a four-day year.
Yeah.
It's so close to its sun.
And it's
big. That's why it's so hot.
So it's almost like a barycenter two-star system in a sense.
They call it Puffy.
Yeah, that's kind of insulting, isn't it?
The Puffy planet.
They're having trouble seeing some of the light through it, which leads them to believe there's a, quote, mystery molecule helping occlude some of the frequencies. But, you know, anything they find at this point, it's such virgin. Actually being able to see the spectra from these exoplanets is such virgin territory, it's all going to be exciting for a while.
That's actually why this is important. Not so much that this planet has carbon dioxide, but it means it looks good that they can detect atmospheres on smaller, more maybe terrestrial size.
Well, so that's planets. What we want is to see these rocky planets and try and figure out what's going on there.
Yeah.
Because then if you see a lot of a certain kind of gas, you could begin saying, well, maybe something's going on here, like technology or plants or animals or something.
I love it. Again, I'm thinking science fiction. When I first read this, I thought, oh, great. We found a planet that killed itself through climate change.
Right.
Fantastic.
That was my first thing. It's like, oh, Venus. What a nice place to have a vacation.
Yeah.
900 degrees and 900.
Anyway, the James Webb, a gift that keeps on.
Oh, and will.
Giving. It's really great. LastPass, which was for many years a sponsor of our shows. It is one of the most used, if not the most used, password manager out there, has admitted they were hacked. Lawrence Abrams at Bleeping Computer had this story 2 weeks ago. He asked them. They clammed up. but finally this week admitted that they were in fact hacked. But to reassure you, if you use LastPass, there's no evidence that customer data or password vaults were compromised. The threat actors stole portions of the LastPass source code and something LastPass calls proprietary LastPass technical information.
It did force me to go check my security settings and turn on two-factor authentication, which I hadn't done.
Ooh, yes.
Change my password, yes, which I hadn't done for a while. And so if nothing else, it at least lit a fire under my butt, because this one scared me.
Yeah, and I guess the worst-case scenario, they don't have the passwords in clear. The worst-case scenario would be, though, that they got the vaults, which most people who's used LastPass store on LastPass's servers, and then could at their leisure attempt to brute force them. And if you didn't have a good master password, you might be vulnerable at that point. Since we all put all the keys to the kingdom in our password vaults, I don't use LastPass anymore, but no matter what you use, that's got everything in it. It would behoove you to use one, a good long password, which is hard because you have to remember that one for your master password. I'm sure, Becky, you did not use monkey123.
No, it was password123.
Much better. And make sure the O's are zeros. Okay, a little, little elite tip there for you. No, use a good long, strong, somewhat. You know what I do? I'm not going to use a 28-character random password. Nobody's got time to memorize that. I don't want to be too explicit about what I'm doing because I don't want you to reverse engineer it. But let's say you took, maybe you memorized, Will, I know because you had a good public school education, you have memorized many great poems. Let's say you had a Lord Tennyson poem committed to memory. Half a league, onward, the light brigade, right?
So a great
Bitcoin.
I don't use
locker.
That as much. Yeah, that's what I use.
So I think there are two interesting things.
Let me explain what I do before you do that. I wouldn't make my password half a league onward, all rolled into the valley of death. I would make it HAL, HAL, HALO, and maybe I would do upper cases on certain kinds of words. Maybe I'd add punctuation. And then, just to make it really good, so that I can remember because I remember the poem and I can reconstruct the beginning part, I will add something else that I know. For instance, what I like to use is my childhood telephone number, which I memorized as a little kid, but is not in the phone book anywhere anymore, I hope. So by adding those 7 or 10 extra digits, I think that's a pretty good password, not likely to be reinforced.
Yeah, so most security experts say that the best password is not a password, but either a phrase or a mnemonic. So a mnemonic is a great
yeah, that's what I'm using as a mnemonic.
Let's take, for example, because I'm here, William Shakespeare in Julius Caesar says, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." So you would have capital T, F, D, capital B, I, N, I, O, S, comma, or exclamation point. Let's have a special character. B, I, O. And that is absolutely, uncrackable because nobody's going, it's not a real word, but it's something that's easy to remember. It's a selection of random things that's completely easy to remember. And that's a great way of doing
it.
Easy
to remember? I'm confused.
Because
the phrase is not in our stars, but in ourselves.
Come on. Did you ever memorize anything in your life?
I wasn't a great elementary school student. I was the one throwing desks out the window in eighth grade.
Do you know a Shakespeare? Do you like to be or not to be? That is the question.
Well, that's too easy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you're right. That's probably not a good one. Go ahead, Becky.
I got another way of thinking about this. This is a Steve Gibson trick, which is to use a password that you know pretty well that might be short and then pack it with symbols.
Yes.
Or characters.
That's why I do that phone number. He calls it password haystacks.
That's right.
Length makes it harder to brute force, even if you add length in a kind of trivial way.
But if you use characters, because there's so many of them, he says that most brute force attack, they don't use as many characters because it's harder and it creates more variables.
Right. So clearly the best password is completely long, random strings of alphanumerics and special characters, but no one can memorize that. So that's why for your master password.
Becky, this Steve Gibson guy is there anywhere I can listen to a podcast?
Where can I
get more of him?
Unboundbooks.com. No, no, that's wrong. you're talking about the host of Security Now, which is now in its 18th year as a podcast. Wow. He just crossed the 18-year-old mark. And at grc.com/haystack.htm, he describes this and shows, you know, how the larger the space that you have to search, the more powerful it is. In fact, it looks like KABC produced a terrific and succinct 2.5-minute explanation that you can watch.
That might actually be my story on this, that KABC because I did it on
GMA.
I bet you. It was great.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was such a smart idea that was simple. Passwords are so hard for people. The thing I also worry about is that if somebody's been pwned in a previous attack and they've used the same password as their master password.
That's the real problem.
That's
Do
what
not
I worry
reuse
about with
passwords,
this,
yes.
With this attack on LastPass. Yeah.
But I think the key takeaway is that Security Now is legal to drink in England, right?
Yes. It can, but it cannot vote yet. No, it can't vote. It can't drink.
No, it can vote.
It can vote.
It can drink. It can
drink.
In
England, it can drink.
Hey, it's all happening over here.
It can't drink.
Get Steve over here quick.
It can no longer drink in the United States of America. So I wouldn't worry about the LastPass hack, although, you know, companies historically have not been very forthcoming. The fact that they took 2 weeks to confirm this is cause for concern. And we don't know, you know, if they know everything that happened. So, yeah, I think that was prudent, Becky. Change your password. And put, if you're not using two-factor, at least on your password vault, do.
Well, that wasn't a choice. I don't recall that being a choice that I didn't opt for it. So that kind of surprises me that it wasn't on by default.
Yeah, they should make you turn it on. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, given what it means to them for this to come out, what would be an appropriate period of time? Because some of those, I think you were talking about, was it Yahoo or who was it that took like 3 years to tell us? Yeah. So a couple of weeks isn't really that bad, is it?
There are regulations now about how quickly you have to report breaches. In California, for instance, I think it's 72 hours. You have to. You have no time at all. And that's a good thing. Let me just see the CCPA.
So even if you're not absolutely sure, you have
California law requires a business or agency to notify any California resident whose unencrypted personal information was acquired. Actually, this does not have a timer, but there are some with timers, maybe GDPR. There certainly are requirements, and I think that it makes sense. There are so many breaches now, though, that we don't report them anymore. Yeah. If I were to do all the breaches this week.
This week in breaches? You could have a whole podcast.
Breaches. It'd be so great.
It could be half security breaches and half new pants.
It'd be six. Yeah, exactly. You may need new pants for this one. Plex.tv this week was hacked.
This week in breaches.
Breached breaches. Or breaches. Actually, breaches are breaches.
Breaches are breaches.
So, Leo, can you, because I'm looking at the rundown, can you explain the Ethereum merge to me?
Oh, my God.
I'm struggling.
Is there enough time in the world to talk about this? Yeah, I think this is actually an important subject. So, how far back do I have to go? Have you ever heard of cryptocurrency?
I have myself lost much money on cryptocurrency.
Oh, you've heard of that, have you? So the promise, you know, it all goes back to the first cryptocurrency, which was Bitcoin, and the invention of something called a blockchain. The easiest way to understand blockchain is it's a database. But unlike a database that you're probably mostly familiar with, where there's a central place for it, the blockchain is a distributed database. Everybody can have a copy of it, which gives you some advantages. You can't; it's harder to fake a transaction on the blockchain or any entry. By the way, it doesn't have to be a transaction. Any entry in that database. In fact, one of the problems with blockchain is there's a lot of crap in there that's not. There's all sorts of stuff in there. If, for instance, and I think it's thought to be the case, there were some child pornography in the blockchain, you couldn't actually get rid of it. It's preserved forever, and it's distributed forever. The current Bitcoin blockchain is huge, hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes. So that's the central technology. And cryptocurrency in general, in order to make that transaction, you have to have something called a proof of work. And that's what the miners are doing. So I want to give Rod a Bitcoin. Congratulations, Rod. The way I transact that is I go to the, I use my Bitcoin wallet. I could, you don't, this doesn't require a third party. You don't need Binance or somebody to do this. I can do this. I go to my wallet, say, send, I have Rod's address. I send Rod this coin. What will then happen is it will then be sent out to all the miners, and they all at once try to solve a difficult math problem, a prime number factorization problem. The first to solve it gets a reward, gets a percentage of that transaction, and the transaction goes through. When they solve it, they add it to the blockchain. It's now part of the blockchain. So the problem with that proof of work setup is it's very, very energy costly because right. You have all these Bitcoin miners all racing to solve this problem. And it, when you solve it, it's a lot of energy. It's designed to be an increasing amount of energy as the currency ages. And so this has historically been a problem. I mean, currently, cryptocurrency transactions are using more power than some nations. I mean, it's a massive amount of power. That's how proof of work works, and it's not ideal. Early on, there was a cryptocurrency called Ethereum, invented by a teenager, of all things. And he proposed that when Ethereum ultimately could use something called proof of stake. This is back in 2014. Instead of proof of work, proof of stake just assigns one miner the job, doesn't use nearly as much energy.
I like this description. In proof of stake systems, computers don't burn energy racing to verify transactions. Instead, crypto investors deposit a certain number of digital coins in a shared pool, and that enters them in a lottery. The winner of the lottery is the one who gets to verify the transaction and wins the reward.
Yeah, that's how they choose this, whoever this is.
That sounds like kind of like you win the lottery and then get to do the work. Congratulations. Yeah. You get to verify
but
this.
But you get a percentage of the transaction.
That's right. But that's what you would get anyway. The difference is only one person's trying to do that instead of everybody trying to do that. They say that'll cut the use of energy by 99%. This has been something that Ethereum has been promising for years. It's finally, we think, going to happen at September 15th. That's called the merge, where Ethereum changes the fundamental transaction backbone for all Ethereum coins. Now, as you might imagine, A, this is technologically incredibly complicated and error-prone. B, there are a large number of people who do not want this to happen because they make money as crypto miners, right? So they're not happy about this. In fact, the merge will probably also be simultaneous with a fork where some number of Ethereum users change to a proof-of-work form of Ethereum, and that's probably going to happen as well. So, the article that you had just read from Becky, a very, very good piece, unusually good piece from the New York Times about the merge, written by David Yaffe Bellany, very, very detailed, talks about the whole thing. I've been wanting to talk about this for some time because it's just a few weeks off, and it could be crazy. It's probably a good thing. Plenty of other cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, will continue to use proof of work, so it's not going to single-handedly solve the energy problem.
How do utilities feel about it?
Do
they find this to be inconvenient, or is it a great profit center for them?
No, because the way these things work, as more coins are generated, as more transactions happen, the difficulty of doing it goes up, which means they use more power. Mm-hmm. So nobody at this point who's trying to make money Bitcoin mining is doing it off the normal grid because it's too you won't make money. Electricity costs too much. So for a long time, all the Bitcoin miners were on hydroelectric dams in China and other places where the cost of electricity was effectively zero. China shut that down, by the way. That was a big blip in one of the reasons Bitcoin dropped so dramatically a couple of years ago. So have I described this accurately? Anybody want to?
I think so. I have a couple questions, though, follow up. So if I'm reading this right, there's $179 billion worth of ether right now based on today's price. And so this shouldn't impact anyone's holdings, correct?
No, not at all. Unless.
Right.
Unless it all goes to hell. I mean, there's also a cryptocurrency veteran quoted by in the Times, Chandler Kuo, says, it's flying the jet and changing the engine in the sky. It's very difficult. It's very dangerous. So it could go belly up. I mean,
but even if this crashes in some way, it doesn't take down the database because obviously that's replicated. But the point is, you couldn't maybe do some transactions until they figure out how to make this.
There are so many problems with cryptocurrency, including the amount of the cost of the transaction and the amount of time. Ethereum gas fees, the cost of those transactions, are wildly unpredictable, often are more than the transaction. So if I gave you a hundredth of an ETH and it cost me $200 to give it to you, that would be a net loss overall. And we've seen this with NFTs where it could be a money loser or trying to get your money back. Or there's all sorts of problems with this. So remember with the DAO, one of the big DAOs, didn't go through. They were gonna buy the Constitution, and they failed. But then the cost of getting your money out of that Constitution DAO was higher than the amount of money you would get back because of gas fees. So this is a big problem. There are lots of problems with cryptocurrency. El Salvador, which left the American dollar as its currency and went to Bitcoin a year ago, is in deep financial doo-doo because they can't pay any bills anymore. Because they're
the gas
down.
Transaction fees to do every transaction. It's like if you went to the bank and said, I want to withdraw $10, and withdrawing $10 costs you $20.
Exactly. Furthermore, you don't know how long it's going to take. And this is the weird thing, Bitcoin, if you pay enough, you can choose how much you're going to pay for the transaction. The more you pay, the more miners will work on it, the more likely it'll go through. But if you say, no, I want the minimum, it may be days before weeks before the transaction goes through. All of this unpredictability is not, in my opinion, good for a monetary system.
The whole point of Ethereum is the thing that I like about it is that it's really tied into the smart contract concept. And so if you're thinking that you're going to have automated transactions that are done through the blockchain, but you don't know how much that transaction fee is going to be, that seems like a fundamental problem with the concept.
Plus, but look at the volatility in the value of the coin. You don't know what you buy a pizza one day for $50 and it was $12 million the next day is not good.
Yeah, although Becky, I think the larger problem with smart contracts and the kind of thing that you were talking about there is that when we talk about, people stealing things off the blockchain, people stealing other people's NFTs, the kind of fraud that goes on with DAOs, it's really reasonable to argue that if the smart contract is law, right? The smart contract is what governs what can and cannot be done. And so if the smart contract allows it and you fraudulently exploited it, then that's technically sort of legal by the smart contract, right? So the bigger problem with smart contracts is that if you exploit them, then any exploitation is legal because the code is law, right?
Man, that's a whole new subset.
We have seen huge. In fact, all you have to do is go to the website. Web3 is going great. Have you seen this website?
No, what's this, Leo?
Web3 is going just great. Is a chronicle of scams, ripoffs, fraud, and it is an endless story. And as you're scrolling through it, by the way, look in the lower right-hand corner because that shows you how much the losses are right now. As I go, it gets higher and higher and higher. I'm stunned that people still think this is a good idea, that they think Web3 is a good idea, that they think NFTs are a good idea, that they think blockchain is a good idea. It is a technology that has some use, a distributed database. Yeah, it's not changing the world. And all it's really doing is relieving people of their money.
So is that so number Benedict, in the
so
lower
Benedict
right?
Evans really well on this on Twitter, which is he says, you know, the really interesting prospect, which is that, you know, the whole point of Web3, if you think about it from the sort of point of view of the evangelizers, is it's distributed, it's away from the banking system. You know, the community writes the rules, the consumer is the, you know, is the owner. All those things are really important. On the other hand, if something goes wrong, then by design, there is no one to complain to.
Right.
And if you have your thing stolen or if you have your account hacked, then there is no one to go to because specifically you own it. It was your fault. And the idea that, you know, to make Web3 and those kind of things useful to the general public, like if you want to make Web3 cryptocurrency, Ethereum merge, whatever, useful to the general public, you have to have some degree of centralization. You have to have someone to complain to when something goes wrong. But that defeats the entire purpose of the Web3 experiment, which is to decentralize everything.
Right.
So it's really going back to an era of like, you know, you break it, you bought it, you screw it up, you lose your money, and there's nobody to complain to.
And of course, the people who have invested heavily in all of this require that somebody come along and give them real dollars for their investment. So there's a lot of fraud going on. There's a lot of cheerleading going on because people can't let this pyramid scheme collapse. And that's, in my opinion, what it is. So it was a bad idea to begin with. Good news, Ethereum won't burn the planet up anymore, maybe. But it's, you know, it's not, I think in the long run, this is not a good idea.
So do you think the NFT is based on creative works? Because being involved with the organizations I'm involved with, of course, we're constantly bombarded by brokers who want to sell us, you guys, you use our services and we'll do an NFT of a picture of Mars and we'll make you tons of money. And we're not falling for it because the only people making money, I suspect, are the brokers. But do you think this whole NFT is based on kind of spurious creative works thing is...
Well, I think it started because there were a lot of Bitcoin bros who needed to launder their money. But I think the real problem right now is that the people who are approaching you are not are the people who are minting the NFTs. And just like Levi's during the gold rush, they made all the money selling dungarees. Yeah. Not
you make money selling the pickaxes, not the gold,
and
right?
I'm exactly. sure they know how to do that. They're just advising.
So people who are approaching you about this are the ones who stand to make money.
Yeah. That's kind of what I thought. Okay.
And also, I wouldn't want to, you know, we've often thought about doing that ourselves. I wouldn't want to capitalize on our audience taking their money. If they buy a lot of people buy NFTs just want to support the artist. That's great. Mm-hmm. You could just donate instead.
That's what Patreon's for, right?
Yeah. But if I think a lot of people buy NFTs, buy it as a speculative vehicle, as a security that they're going to sell back at some point and make money on. And that's something that bothers me. We are really close to the SEC saying that these are securities. And that's
always what they've been, right?
Yes.
And your good friend and mine, Jason Calacanis, harps on about this on Twitter a lot, about the fact that, you know, crypto currency NFTs, they're securities, they're just not currently recognized as such, right?
And if they are, then the SEC regulates it. There are many who are true believers in crypto who say, yes, we need that. We need some regulation. We need to understand what the rules are, at least, so we can go forward. But there are many who fear that as well. And regulation usually means taxation. Some people don't like that idea. The whole idea of some of this is an anonymity, right? But as we've learned again and again, you're not really anonymous. In fact, Yeah, maybe.
Well, that's too bad. I want to do an NFT of my Mars flag that I took up to the Arctic, but...
Let me see. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the flag you designed. Is that on the space.com?
Well, design, quote unquote. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about the flag story. What every season, is there a new flag?
So this was based on the notion that the explorers, polar explorers of the heroic era all took along their battle flags, right? So Shackleton had his family crest, and Robert Scott, who was not a very good leader, as he trudged his men into death and oblivion, had his family crest, and then they'd have a larger. So that, what you're seeing there is a picture of Pascal, who
runs the place and owns it, putting up a flag, which I had made for him, of the first long Shackleton expedition. That was 1907 to try and reach the South Pole. And that Shackleton's family crest on kind of a standard bearing background or something. And I thought, well, we should have something like that. So yeah. There was one on the whole internet. There was one image of that Shackleton flag from the original thing. So I had a graphic artist redo it for me. And then I thought, well, I want to have something for me. So I decided to have the Martian war machines taking out the planet Earth with this Mars rising in the background.
This is from H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds.
Yeah. So that's, we left it up there. So we're going to go back next year and see how many tatters are left.
Does it survive the winter pretty well?
No, it's brutal up there. Yeah. I mean, it's brutal enough in the summer. We were getting 50-mile-an-hour gusts and temperatures with chill down in the 20s, which, you know, there's a lot of people in Minnesota that would say, oh, the 20s, hey, it's not so bad. But up there with the grit and the constant UV, because there's an ozone hole up there and so forth, it's a whole different deal. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pull this back.
You did get burned a little bit, yeah?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
And we tried to be careful.
I didn't realize there was a hole there.
Yeah.
So that means you're really getting
and that's on top of the ice melting, and now the polar bears are more hungry, so you got to constantly be looking out for them because they're prowling around saying, hey, I haven't had a seal to eat for a week. You look like five seals. I'll eat you. So
wow.
You have to carry a shotgun everywhere you go. Yeah,
Becky,
it's pretty wild.
Becky, what kind of reporting do you do on cryptocurrency? I'm sure that people are very interested in this.
Zip, none, zero. But
is that your idea or ABC's idea?
A little bit of both. I'm much more in the everyday, practical, news you can use consumer.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm really interested in Venmo. The Cash App story this week is crazy to me that, you know, you're seeing people having their accounts drained. And those are the kind of stories that really catch my attention, the ones that are much more in the hands of the everyday user. And it makes me super nervous to talk about crypto at the broad broadcasting levels in terms of try this.
This is actually, we've been kind of getting into this on the radio show because there's a well-known radio guy, finance guy, who says, don't use Venmo, Cash App, and really don't use Zelle. They're dangerous. And I'm saying, well, I use them all the time. They're no more dangerous than your bank or cash. But their point is, and I guess this is true probably even your reporting, your audience, people don't understand that they're tied directly to your bank account.
Tied directly to your bank account, and you have far less recourse if something goes wrong.
But as you know, if I took $100 out of the bank and gave it to you, it's not the bank's responsibility to make it good. You know, if I get scammed that way, it's not. So people somehow think that if you use Zelle or Cash App or Venmo and get scammed, it's the responsibility of the bank.
But is it the difference between if you use a credit card, if you get scammed, your credit card will reimburse you, right? That's part of the...
They had to do that because no one would have used credit cards. But I don't...
Yeah, so it's the difference between doing a credit card transaction where you're going to get reimbursed if you get scammed and a direct bank transaction where you're not going to, which I guess is the difference between going to a merchant and giving them cash or credit, right?
Well, and I was really saying, no, Clark Howard's the guy. Clark Howard's wrong and Zelle is fine. Go ahead. In fact, somebody called the radio show. I said, no, because she'd heard this. I said, no, it's fine. But it's like cash. Don't give it to somebody you don't know.
But the hacks are different.
Well, I actually want to talk about the hacks in a second. But separate from the hacks, which are an issue, just be careful because it's like cash and you're not going to get made whole if you give it to somebody. And the reason I mention this, you know Jennifer very well, my ex-wife, the mother of my children.
Bought me a miniskirt once.
Did she really?
Yeah, she bought me a great miniskirt once at the outlets in Petaluma. It was so sweet. Aww,
just thanks. For no reason, said, here's a miniskirt?
She said she was shopping, she saw it, and she thought I'd like it. It was the cutest thing.
Wow. I don't think I ever saw you in it, but that's probably good for the best.
Yeah.
So,
anyways, I totally hijacked your story.
Love Jennifer.
I'm so sorry.
And I was wearing.
Are we just going to go into things that the Laporte family has bought? Because Leo bought me a really nice bottle of Red Zinfandel once.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
really,
nice.
I've ever since bought Petaluma Zinfandel whenever I'm in a respectable London eatery.
Anyway,
did he buy you a lemon drop?
Oh, that was a mistake.
That's his drink of choice.
That was a big mistake. I've stopped with the lemon drops. Too many horrible things have happened at my at my home
that we will not go into.
but which, Becky, I will mention if I'm required to do your eulogy, I will bring that up. I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm sure you will outlive me by hundreds of years. But if for some reason you get lost on a kayak, you disappear on a stand-up paddleboard, I'm going to tell this. Well, I have many stories. I have so many stories. I'll have to pick and choose.
Wow. I need to know. So anyways,
none of them reflecting poorly on Becky, I might add. No. All right.
As we're launching your little finger into space, they'll be telling us about the miniskirt issue.
This girl liked to have some F-U-N.
Jennifer and I both use Zelle to send money to her kids and stuff, but she got scammed. And once you get scammed out of money on Zelle, you're right. You ain't getting back. So you really have to treat it. And she's a smart person. So that really opened my eyes as to how easy it is to say, oh, I need to send this person money. They said Zelle, no problem. I've been using this to send money to our kids. I'll just send them that money. And that's it. It's gone.
So I know it's a different process, but is PayPal a step safer
same
than
thing.
That?
No, same thing.
Same issue?
It's Venmo is PayPal. So it's the same thing. And I think the only reason credit cards back up your stupidity is because no one would have used them in the early days, and they kind of got in the habit of it. I wish we'd made Zelle and Cash App and all that do the same, but we didn't. Apple Pay is the same. Anything you're sending money from your bank account, you're at risk. Now, the hacks are a big problem because if I do hack your account, I got it all. I got everything that's in your bank account. And again, with no recourse. So you need to use good passwords, all the same things you always do.
So after this Cash App story came up, basically the story was that multiple people are reporting on social that their accounts have been drained when they haven't made any payments to anyone. And there are reports of passwords, of user account names and information associated with the accounts being listed on the dark web, with some people saying that may or may not be good data. Other people saying, yeah, I got a lot of money out of this. Reviewers on the dark web. But what's interesting is I signed up for the Cash App this morning, and it's you don't put a password in. It uses your email or your phone number, but there's the security by default is pretty lean. There's no PIN number turned on. You have to go into the settings and turn the PIN number on, and there's no authenticator turned on by default. So I can think of a bunch of scams, like the Google Voice scams. I don't know if you've heard about those, where people can basically get access to your phone number and therefore take over your two-factor authentication, where this could be a real problem. And this is the kind of stuff that makes me very nervous and that I end up reporting on a lot.
As you should. And I have to say, I have amended my recommendations. Not that they're inherently unsafe, although the Cash App does sound like it's inherently unsafe. But the risk is so much higher because it's tied to your bank account and because there's no recourse, that it's probably best not to use these, I guess, right?
Well,
it doesn't sound like you should use Cash. I use Cash App all the time. That's Jack Dorsey's company. That's Block.
It is. Yeah. I just wouldn't assume that it's secure by default. And that's a lot to ask for the average consumer. That would be my request, is that there was a lot more default security, two-factor authentication, and beyond, and a PIN number to actually access
the It should have all of those secure things. But then it's harder to use, right? And they want you to use it. So
what's the big picture solution to this other than DNA sampling or something? I mean,
well, this is such a fundamental thing in technology is the idea of authentication. How do you, even prior to technology, how do you prove you are who you are? That's why we have passwords. That's why we have pins. We have all these things. And I think that there are going to be better ways to do this. This FIDO2 passkeys solution that we've been talking about, that Microsoft, Google, and Apple now are actively supporting. I think that's going to be an improvement over passwords. The problem is there's always a trade-off, it seems like almost always a trade-off between security and convenience. And most companies who are trying to do business with you are going to err on the side of convenience because they want you to do business. So I think that's part of the problem. I'm sure Cash App knows how to make itself 100% secure, but they fear it would be too hard to use.
I also think some of the big players will absorb cash transfers into their ecosystems because their authentication is more robust in their devices. So take Apple, for example. If I'm going to text money to my kids, I have to use facial recognition to text it from my phone to theirs, but they've got a password on the phone, so do I, and you have to double up with some sort of PIN or facial recognition to send the money. So that's built into the ecosystem, and I can see that being a strong case for security by device, security built in on. That's like a three-factor
authentication. And that's what Passkeys is all about, is that your device, because it's using biometrics, fingerprint or face, is really can somewhat be trusted to be a proof that you are you who you say you are, as long as you're using those biometrics. Anyway,
so, I mean, it's the definition of security versus convenience, right?
Yes, exactly. But it is more convenient if you're using Touch ID or Face ID on a device. That's pretty convenient. That's not a password, so that's why.
And think about something like Mint, which is tied to all my accounts. And that has not only is it on my device and I have to use facial recognition to open it up, but then when I open the app itself, it acts for a secondary facial check.
Right.
So that makes a lot of sense to me. It doesn't help on the web, but you know, in terms of on my browser or my computer, but I think there's a lot to be said for that.
That's what Passkeys does, though, because now when you're on your computer on a site, it'll say, okay, open your phone, log in. And so it is tying that device with biometrics to websites.
Do you guys have two-factor authentication for just general credit card transactions on the web? Because that's one thing that's become increasingly normalized over here, which is you can be on Amazon, you can be on any old website in the world. You put your credit card details in, and it will insist on texting you a six-digit code.
No, we don't do that here. We have the number on the back of your credit card.
which everybody's written down anyway. So I mean, it never fails to amaze me. The somebody once joked that the surefire way to create a $1 billion American startup is to take European or British bank technology from 10 years ago and bring it to America.
That's because
it is so poor. So one of the things that we do over here is if you use your card anywhere that you haven't used it in the last 2 or 3 days online, it will 100% ask you to put in your phone number. And if it's the phone number that they have matched on your account at your credit card thing, they will send you a text message with a six-digit code, and you've got to put your six-digit code into the web app or the iPhone app or whatever it is you're using in order to authenticate the transaction. So 2FA has just become like almost absolutely standard for credit card transactions over here.
Yeah. Will, you didn't just show your credit card number, right?
416982.
Just don't show the three-digit code on the back, okay? Please, I beg of you. We're going to take a little break. We have to. We're way behind. The problem is, when I have a panel like this, it's just hard to stay on. I just have so much fun. It's so nice having Becky Worley here from ABC. No, that's not Becky. That's Becky. Becky has not yet grown
a beard.
My facial
hair.
Yeah, no.
Oh, you don't want to look like me.
Becky, you got the peach fuzz. It's fantastic.
I kind of do. That's being over 50, that happens, friends. I hate to
say that. Oh, she is not over 50. Look how young.
No way.
People were saying in the chat room, how does Becky not age?
Get lost.
How does she not age? She looks fantastic. You
turn off those filters so we can see.
Gorgeous.
Right.
But your kids are in high school now.
High school. Crazy.
Wow. Great pictures on Instagram. I thank you for letting me follow you on Instagram because it's how I stay up with you.
No.
Great to see you.
The pros of social media. I love it.
It's the only good.
There's lots of cons, but there's lots of good.
No, it's the only good thing about it. And I hate that Instagram's turning into TikTok because I really just want to see pictures of my friends. That's all I really care about. Pictures by my friends or of my friends. Mr. Will Harris. Ooh, unbound.com is the awesomest idea in book publishing. 15% off Unbound titles, including the new Douglas Adams 42.
With Twit 15.
If you use the offer code TWIT15, that's very generous of you. But boy,
well,
I look at all this stuff.
It's such a pleasure to be back here for always.
We love you. And I want to buy
every
book.
I can't pretend that I'm not aging in the same way that Becky isn't aging. But, you know, maybe, getting slightly better with age, maybe.
Oh, you look great. I'll never forget, Lisa and I are in London for 5 days. And we're walking down the street. We run into Will. It's like in the biggest cities in the world. And we just run into you. You go, hi.
Fantastic. Leo, yeah, Jesus,
amazing.
You're here.
I know one guy in London, and I ran into him. Anyway, great to have you. Unbound.com. And, of course, my spaceman, Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, space.nss.org, and the author of... And
here come the books.
I got the pile, all the pile books. That's a... This is my favorite one.
Those aren't all of them. Those
no,
are only a quarter of them.
Close.
Yeah.
I couldn't lift it. It was all of them. This is my best one, though, which came out a couple of years ago on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, First on the Moon. And I never get to show this on the radio show, but it's a picture book about Apollo 11. It's incredible. You did such a nice job of this.
Thanks.
I love it. And that's
and it may be one of the last pictures books because they're
so expensive.
They're not doing them anymore.
No,
yeah.
No. Interplanetary
thing.
Robots, Amazing Stories of the Space Age, Blueprint for a... was going to be a Death Star, but they had to change it to Battlestar.
Thanks, Disney.
And, of course, thanks, Disney, and the Ad Astra magazine. If you want to read about his trip to Mars on planet Earth... Space.com has a lot of the stories, but also they'll appear on in Ad Astra, the magazine, in coming issues. And, of course, Rod's the host of This Week in Space with Tarek Malik of Space.com.
Who is at the Artemis launch.
Is he?
Yeah. Oh. I tried to message him to see if we could get him on for a couple of seconds.
Oh, it would have been fun. All right. Well, keep your eye peeled. He might show up. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. We were just talking about finances. Wealthfront is a financial services company. They were founded in 2008 with a goal to make building long-term wealth delightfully easy. Look, if you saw the market lately, you probably don't like what you saw. You shouldn't be looking at it every day. Seeing as a matter of perspective, Wealthfront's an investing app with a different vision, one focused on this so important long-term wealth, designed to weather any market condition, even the one we're in now. With Wealthfront, you get a pre-built, diversified is important, portfolio that spreads your investing eggs across more baskets. It's the time-tested way to build long-term wealth and weather whatever volatility is happening. The trick to wealth isn't timing. It's just simply time. By automating your investments, it's easier to invest regularly regardless of the ups and downs of volatility. Don't pay attention to that. If you want to invest for long-term, while the market is basically having a clearance sale, like right now, don't wait. This is a great time. Wealthfront makes it super easy to start investing. You'll just answer a couple of questions about how you feel about risk, your tolerance, and your timing, because you know what your future plans are. They will automatically build a personalized portfolio for the long term, and that's it. Sign up today. You'll get a $50 bonus. Wealthfront.com/twit. Voted the best overall robo-advisor by Investopedia. 500,000 people use Wealthfront to build their wealth. $27 billion in managed assets. I just think they do such a good job. And don't read the daily papers. Don't put the stock prices up on your phone. Don't look at the Dow Jones. Get a bonus $50 when you start investing with Wealthfront. Sign up today. You've been thinking about this. Don't put it off. Now is a really good time. Wealthfront.com/twit. Wealthfront.com/twit. Of course, they're a sponsor, so this is a paid endorsement. We have to say that, you know, for legal reasons. This bit of investing wisdom is a paid endorsement from Wealthfront. Wealthfront.com/twit. Anybody watch The House of the Dragon? Anybody? HBO?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you have HBO in the UK?
No, it airs over here on Sky.
Sky?
We don't have HBO over here, but it airs on Sky.
All right. Did you watch it, Becky? Are you a Game of Thrones fan?
I cannot explain this, but despite the fact that I love full contact sports like football, have played rugby, I can't stomach that.
It's too violent?
Too violent.
Well, and this, by the way, this premiere episode last Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
It was very controversial there's a childbirth scene, which is extremely graphic and gory. And a lot of people said, I didn't need to see that. The you know, the traditional HBO house of ill repute brothel romp, that's fine. But you got to do that. But the
child... Everyone needs a little romp, right? You need a little brothel. Brothel romp. What are you really doing?
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of my middle name, brothel romp. No. No, I shouldn't have said that.
Wow.
Not true. Not true. It's not
Leo
true.
Leo Brothel Romp Laporte. That's what we call him.
There is no Tyrion.
Becky's got the funniest look on her face through this whole thing.
She doesn't. What is going on? She knows me better than that.
He's not a brothel romper.
I'm not a brothel romper. I have never been a brothel romper. How many times have you tried to get me to romp in a brothel? But no, I say no every time.
No, he says no all the time. It's infuriating.
He prefers to watch live childbirth. He's the Matt Smith sitting in the corner and looking miserable while everyone else is having a brother romp.
Yeah. So HBO, I'm so sorry. They shouldn't allow me on live anything, right? It's just a mistake. HBO said 10 million viewers watched the episode. That is a very big number. In fact, the biggest start for a series in HBO history. When we talked about it last week, there was some concern that people, because of the... kind of the bitter taste from the end of Game of Thrones, people wouldn't watch this. Like, I'm done with that series. Apparently not. In fact, it did so well, they immediately greenlit it for a second season. And I didn't know this, but HBO has 5 other spinoffs in development. Ugh.
Wow.
Well, and not only do they have the spin-offs in development, but they have the Easter eggs of the spin-offs in the House of the Dragon opening.
Oh, now, wait a minute. So you watched this more closely than I did. Tell me.
So one of the... I am a bit of a geek for this stuff. One of the reasons that I love watching it is so I can listen to podcasts afterwards where you get to sort of deconstruct it, right?
HBO has its official one. Is that the good one? No.
It's quite good. I would say the best one is a chap that you surely know, a chap called Dave Chen, who has a website called Decoding TV, where he does breakdowns of all of this stuff. And one of the things that they talk about is the main sort of princess in it.
Yeah.
Gives a little minor lore dump in the middle of the episode about a queen called Nymeria, who... sails to Dawn and then burns all her ships off the coast of Dawn in order to say that she's, you know, their people are running no longer, that we're going to burn the ships because we're staying here come hell or high water. And the story of Nymeria, the queen, is one of the other spin-offs that is in development.
Oh, damn.
At HBO. And of course, Nymeria, as a strong woman, was the name of Arya Stark's wolf, Dire Wolf.
Nymeria.
In the first series of Game of Thrones.
You're right. I knew that name.
It's almost like there's a little plan.
You know, there's a moment in it, they have a joust. Brutal, vicious. I mean.
Also, what are the rules of that joust? At what point do you club the guy's head in versus just go, oh, are you?
Sometimes
sorry.
You go.
That's my bad.
No, and so, yeah, right.
Oh,
sometimes
my
you just.
Bad. I'm not up for it. I don't really feel like the guy who got his head clubbed in really had the chance
to
yield.
He didn't get a fair chance to yield. No, he immediately. But at the end of it, when it's over, the knight who won takes his helmet off. And there's this moment where the two princesses look at each other knowing, meaningfully and say, oh, he's Dornish. And I thought, oh, crap, what does that mean? I got to watch all 8 seasons of... I can't remember. Dornish, what does that mean? So I'm sure there's some stuff...
Listen to the recap.
I have to listen to the recap. The reason I bring this up...
I was just doing a little bit of... Oh, go ahead.
No, you.
I was just doing the math on how much this thing cost.
Yes, that's the reason I bring it up.
$20 million an episode for what is this thing called? House of the Dragon.
House of the Dragon. Right. Yeah. What is it called?
Now that sounds like a lot, right?
Yeah.
But get this: $30 million an episode for Stranger Things,
right?
And $40 million an episode for the Lord of the Rings prequel.
Get ready, because that's coming next week. And this is the real battle: it's Amazon and streaming versus Warner Brothers and traditional filmmaking, television, HBO. I mean, admittedly, HBO is now as much a streamer as they are a cable channel. But really, that's the battle. Because Amazon essentially has unlimited funds. They don't have to make the money back in the streaming thing.
Is this a loss leader for them?
I think it can be, yes.
Yeah, so the way that someone explained it to me, which I thought was like a really good analogy and maybe will resonate with your American audience, is the Lakers, the Los Angeles Lakers, right, in NBA, yes, like the yes. premium NBA franchise. Like everybody wants to work for the Lakers. But the Buss family that owns the Lakers, that's their business.
Right.
Right. So they have to make good business decisions for the Lakers.
Are you going to compare this to the Lakers? The Mighty Ducks?
No. What we're going to go with is that's HBO. So HBO has to make sensible decisions and good money.
Because they're like the Lakers. They're like the Buss family. Yes.
Because that's
it's their
business.
Own money.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas Amazon, ironically, is the Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer owns the Los Angeles Clippers and could just spend however much money he wants because the Clippers aren't his money. That's like the side hustle. The Clippers are the side hobby for Amazon. Prime Video and The Lord of the Rings is just like a few hundred million there, a few hundred million here. That's not going to impact on the core business. And it's the difference between operating a streamer as your core business or a streamer as your little side hustle on the way to your core business.
I would actually compare it to the Anaheim Ducks, which is it's the LA Lakers and the Anaheim Ducks. The Ducks are owned by Disney, which made a movie called The Mighty Ducks. They make money off of the merchandising, the branding. They don't have to make money off the hockey team. So it's like that, though. You're right. They don't have to make money off the prime.
Oh, I didn't get hyper local enough. I should have.
You
gone
need
for
hyper
local.
No one in England has ever heard of the Anaheim Ducks, so I don't blame you.
The other thing is that the Amazon play, the difference is they can, and Disney with the Mighty Ducks, is the cross promotion that can exist between their properties. So not only is it, it can be a loss leader for other things, but they can use it to cross promote other things that are more profitable.
So,
whereas HBO can't really have Matt Smith in House of the Dragon sort of catching up on an episode of Sex and the City.
Now we've really gone too far afield for me. I don't understand anything that's happening.
At some point, do these serializations or spinoffs from Game of Thrones start becoming like the whole Law and Order thing?
God.
If so,
Game of Thrones
dreadful
special
as that
victims
is,
unit.
Yeah, right. As awful as that gets, you know, if you're looking at a third or fourth tier spinoff, and I'm just thinking of this because of my time with Star Trek and watching that whole thing fracture into the weirdness that it has. What are the budget limits become then? Because, I mean, you hear these numbers for Stranger Things. I heard that number, I think when I was working on Trek, a big show for us was like $1.1 million.
Oh, yeah.
That was expensive.
$40 million an episode.
Right. So, but it looks like a movie. So part of my brain is saying, well, that kind of makes sense. Because, you know, when you're producing, you have a money meter running in the back of your mind all the time, right? Part of that makes sense for the kind of visuals they're getting. But you've got to commit to making what would be a whole franchise of movies in one season. What's the average? 8 to 10?
Yes. Yeah.
That's what most of these are.
And
like,
then you start doing these spins. Well, can the fifth or sixth tier spinoff from Game of Thrones, NCIS have the same budget as the first one?
In order to acquire all of these, AT&T took on $50 billion in debt. So HBO, Warner is deep in debt.
Maybe they should buy Yahoo. That'd be a good idea.
Right. Huge debt. So they don't have a lot of runway. They've canceled a bunch of shows. They canceled Batgirl, $90 million investment because they could write it off on their taxes. Batgirl? You have been away.
Yeah. Have you heard of this? They did another
one. You're gone a month. They shot a movie for $90 million and then canceled it.
Oh,
Batgirl. You probably don't know about Scoob, the Christmas show either. But I think that's what you're seeing now is big, big money. And Netflix even, which is still the king of streamers, 8% of all streams are Netflix streams, is running against headwinds. Their stuff is very expensive.
And what you're seeing is the, if you look at the news today, which is the increasing, is this a word? Streamerization of cinema?
I like it, yeah.
Which is the new, you know, the big hot Marvel property that everyone's wondering what's going to happen to is Fantastic Four. And we heard the news, I think this morning or yesterday, that Matt Shackman, who helmed WandaVision for Disney, is going to be the person in charge of Fantastic Four. And a lot of the film Twitter commentary was, well, I guess we're not hiring film directors to make films anymore. We're TV-izing film, right? Which is effectively what Disney has done. If you look at the Star Wars series, the Marvel series, which are all shot in the volume, it's the TV-ization, the streaming-ization of cinema.
Well, this is the hypothesis that we're at peak TV, right? That because of COVID, because of streaming, because of multi-tiered pricing options, that peak TV is now. And whether this can last or not is the question. And we're seeing that with the financial troubles being experienced by the likes of Netflix and others. So, you know, is this the peak of peak TV? Maybe.
This is the article from the Financial Times, which is hidden behind a very expensive paywall. That, in fact, the guy who coined the term peak TV, John Landgraf, has been predicting it since 2016. But he said this
year...
Well,
if you predict it every year, you're going to be right one year, right?
He said this year it really is the peak of the peak TV era. He is chair of Disney's FX network. Amazon Prime... Lord of the Rings, $465 million budget. They could make Top Gun Maverick three times over. House of Dragons, the Dragon, $200 million for 10 episodes. Disney Plus has Star Wars Andor. She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, which is probably the best name of any, of any of them.
That's like Sharknado.
That's good.
The thing is that companies like Amazon, Apple... are subsidizing it with their profits, vast profits from other arenas, but Netflix, HBO.
Meantime, Leo, in the rundown, we've got the Netflix advertising plan, which will be about half the current price, $7 to $9 a month, with 4 minutes of ads per hour.
Doesn't that feel like a Hail Mary? Like this is it.
But that's what Amazon's doing with Freevee.
Freevee, but they tell you this is free. It's crappy TV.
Yeah. Well, they didn't tell me that. Right?
Freevee is an add-on. It's sort of like, it's not Amazon Prime.
It's kind of like what happened with cable TV where, I mean, we all remember because we're older, that cable was originally, you sent it out to the hinterlands for people that couldn't get real television.
Right.
And then it became this thing with all this cool programming and you paid for it so you wouldn't have ads. And then suddenly it was filled with ads just like everything else. And I feel like we're being... hit with that again.
Yawn in our chat room says Freevee is Amazon's subprime video.
It's so bad.
And of course, default swap video.
If you remember network television from the day, and again, thinking back on Trek episodes, you had four or five ad breaks, depending on what era it was. They were programmed in. They were written into the script. So at the end of each act, you did the close-up of the
lead character. I know, you know what the best thing in the world is?
Staring off camera. But now they just drop the ads in with a battle ad.
Yeah,
so
I know.
It's awful.
The best thing in the world, though, is to binge a show that was ad-supported, and then the character looks off and it goes black, and then it comes back, and you didn't see it.
You're
was
on him again.
I love that.
But that's but Leo, that's how we experienced so much TV over here growing up.
Like, you now realize how unnatural that was.
Watching Star Trek: The Next Generation on BBC, and you would get the moment where Picard is suddenly sort of looking into the distance very meaningfully, and you think, oh, God, what's about to happen? And you'd get a fade to black and then a fade back in again.
And now we know.
And you had, it was only, you know, as a you know, 9-year-old watching Star Trek, you'd have no idea why that was the case.
Brits have a very different relationship to advertising. When we do our ads, I always hear from people who listen in the UK saying, wait a minute, you're the host of the show and you're doing the ad? Like, that's like... apparently verboten in, well, that's probably not the right word to use, but
they have this thing in the UK called media
German.
Ethics.
You're sort of in the right geographical area.
Yeah, that's
true. Know, you were a few thousand miles.
Bad rugby.
It's very strange because we have a very weird relationship to the BBC, which obviously is not ad supported. But which therefore kind of skews our thoughts on advertising.
We were talking about that in the Twit forums at twit.community because Big D lives in Germany where there's a very robust public television. People still watch broadcast TV there because of it. Here in the U.S., public television has been eviscerated and
runs everything but commercials
and
at this point.
Constant pledge breaks. But the good news is there's such a diversity in a rich ecosystem of streaming stuff, when you throw YouTube in, which is streaming, that there's, I don't think we need public TV. We've got, you know, anybody who wants to do something can do it.
Although it's fascinating to listen to the kind of, you know, and you guys included, the media ecosystem talk about, you know, the different streaming services that are available. You know, one of the films that I was really keen to watch in the last few weeks has been Prey.
Yeah, what a good movie.
It's a prequel directed by a friend of the show, Dan Trachtenberg, right?
Yeah.
Which is a Hulu streaming original. And then you go, Hulu doesn't exist outside of the United States. In the United States, it's a Disney Plus original. In the United Kingdom, it's a Disney Plus original. And you realize how much of the sort of conversation is based on one market, being the US. And we talk about the sort of the cable infrastructure and the advertising infrastructure. Actually, you know, that is just one market. And actually, the rest of the world doesn't operate in quite the same way.
We don't even know. I don't know. And I imagine most viewers don't know. Was Prey made as a movie? Was it made for a network? Was it made just for Hulu? I think it was made just for Hulu, right?
No. So it's an incredible story. It was a Fox picture, which was due to go to cinemas, theaters, as you would say.
Oh, you mean movie palaces? Yeah.
Movie palaces. and then when Disney bought Fox... Fox had a deal whereby anything that went to theaters would then first streaming rights go to Netflix.
Right.
And so rather than put it in theaters and have the streaming rights go to Netflix, they chose to stream it on Hulu as first run.
I have never seen a Predator movie before. I'm ashamed to admit. John's.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't get
ashamed.
To the chopper!
John Salinas said, Prey is great. I said, I've never seen a Predator movie. He said, it's okay. You'll understand it's an alien and they got to kill it before it kills them. And I loved it. What I loved was the Native American angle on this.
Well, and there's an entire version of the movie that's in Comanche.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It's wild.
And you get to watch it without all the posturing of Predator, which was kind of.
Yeah, see, I don't know
exhausting.
About that. I was not there for
between
that.
Him and the other leads, it was just grim.
Yeah.
You know, and it's our old friend, you know, Dan Trachtenberg of Totally Rad with Alex Albrecht and Jeff Kanata. So it's a little homegrown production.
It's kind of neat. He's doing good. It's a good show.
What was the budget on this?
$50, $53.22. I actually watched the
I think the budget was my £7.99 that I pay a month for Disney Plus.
I watched the making of it. It's very cool, but yeah, I don't think it was a big budget film. I mean, mostly they made it.
It was quite chunky because it was going to be a proper Fox picture.
Yeah,
but before Disney.
I'm glad it aired.
But
it's
well worth a watch if anybody's watching it.
Even if you've never seen a Predator movie, it's quite good.
Yeah. Like the
you won't like it, Becky. It's very violent.
I liked the Predator movies. They were good. So much bicep.
Like, there's no bicep in this. Our hero is a Native American
Carl
girl.
Weathers, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No bicep. Yeah.
Get the guns out.
Actually, Predator's the best looking guy in the whole show.
Well, he's got that cootie catcher mouth, right?
Yeah, that's a little bad. That's off-putting, but he's got six pack. Actually, he's got like a 12-pack because he's an alien.
Hey, right. You know, Rod, I wanted to circle back to your question about all these derivative works and how all these prequels and sequels and everything like that, and how can they continue to monetize these? And one interesting thing that I actually learned in grad school was when Blue's Clues, the kids show, first came out.
Great show, yeah.
They only had enough money on PBS to make one episode a week, but the time slot was for 5 episodes a week. And they decided, okay, we're just going to air it and know that on Monday we're going to get the big ratings, and then the kids will tune in on Tuesday and realize, oh, I've already seen this one, and the ratings will gradually go down as the week progresses. The exact opposite happened. The kids watched on Monday, they tuned in on Tuesday and said, oh, I know this, watched it. And then they wanted to come back again on Wednesday because they wanted something predictable, something they knew the template of.
Right.
That the world was so chaotic.
Yeah.
And they could predict how the storyline was going to end. So actually, Friday had the highest ratings. And I kind of have this hypothesis that in the world we live in now, it's really nice to watch a show that's kind of new, but you basically know what's going to happen.
There's a bunch of network bosses.
That's
a
really
taking notes of what she just said.
Yeah.
So what I want to know, and this is stepping back a bit, But anybody here a Top Gear fan, the original BBC show?
Yeah. Yep.
You bet.
How did that become the most watched, highest grossing film in the show in the English language for a decade? It's three fat middle-aged guys blowing up cars, you know? I mean, I want to know that secret. I'm past middle age, but I mean, it sounds really like a great idea.
Same recipe, different ingredients. Man.
I love it, but I still don't understand.
It's the same show over and over.
Yeah.
So there are, not to take this show on too much of a rat hole, but there are two answers, which is one, every middle-aged man wishes they could hang out with all those.
They all want to be Jeremy.
We all want to be Jeremy Clarkson, yeah. Exactly.
You don't want to be that person, but you want to be able to hang out with those people. Yeah. And two is the familiarity of it's a show every week that's not about cars. It's about friendship.
Yes.
And to Becky's point, one of the hot shows right now that I am absolutely obsessed with, which a lot of my dad friends have clued me into, is Bluey, which if you haven't watched Bluey, holy smokes, it is one of the greatest shows on television. It's Australian, it's a cartoon, it's about a little family of two parents and two kids, and every show is 7 to 9 minutes, and you will learn something, you will laugh, you will cry. It will, whether or not you have kids, it doesn't matter. It's got that that wonderful sort of aesthetic of kids watching it will get the very textual text, and the parents watching it will get the super text and the subtext.
The weird thing is, you don't even have kids and you're watching this show. It's kind of amazing.
Oh my word! Yeah. So all my dad friends are saying this is the best thing that they're watching, whether or not they've got kids. So I thought, well, I have to watch it. And it's as somebody who doesn't have kids, you're watching it, going, this is fantastic.
Okay, tell the truth. How many glasses of Irish whiskey in are you when you're watching this?
No. The chat room agrees with him. Chumley in the chat room says Caillou needs a beat down with a rubber hose, but
absolutely.
Bluey is life.
Caillou
is amazing.
I've never seen this.
About Bluey. He has a little kid.
He knows. Yeah, yeah.
Our kids are almost the same age. Did you get into the first two seasons of SpongeBob?
No.
I had never done LSD, but it was as close to LSD watching television as I can imagine. But it was brilliant.
Well,
and then the network stepped in and took control.
One of our hosts here on the network's wife is starring in the stage play of SpongeBob.
Oh, no.
Here in Petaluma, and we are all going to see it. And I hope you know Queen Pruitt is going to have a applauding audience, a clack in there, cheering her on. What character does she play?
Sandy Cheeks.
Woo, yeah.
Pretty good role.
That's a good
role.
That is a good role.
I don't know. I've never.
We like Sandy Cheeks.
Okay.
We do.
Don't get stuck as Patrick.
We do.
You don't want to be Patrick.
We do. Becky and I are saying we're glad our kids are grown. We don't have to watch any more Barney. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah. You're my special Leo.
All right. We got to take a break. We're going way over time. I got to take a break. We will come back. We'll talk more. Wrap this thing up, because what a great panel with Becky Worley and Rod Pyle and Will Harris. You guys are my best friends, man. Straight from the heart. That's what this show is, a bunch of friends getting together, talking about cars.
It's the Top Gear of tech.
It's the Top Gear of tech. One of the ways we bring this show to you ever since day one when we started shooting video was with our new tech, TriCaster 2 Elite, the most complete live production system on the planet. And what an empowering technology for us as podcasters. When we first started video, I said, well, how am I going to switch it? What am I going to do? You know, when we were at Tech TV, Becky, we had $2 million control rooms with Grass Valley switchers, and we had very, very expensive cameras and all of that. The TriCaster 2 Elite, any TriCaster product, has allowed me to do with Twit for a fraction of the cost, better than Tech TV ever did. It's actually more than just a live video production system. It's an all-encompassing digital media solution that lets us create content, and you create content for the internet, for mobile. Yeah, even TV now uses new tech. Late in 2001, new tech unleashed an updated version of the TriCaster 2 Elite with lots of new features. the live call connect feature, which means you can call in. We're going to actually, I think maybe that's what we need to do. We're going to launch a new fall show in January with call-ins, and I think that might be the solution. It now supports Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and FaceTime as inputs to any production. Selectable audio and video returns enable the TriCaster 2 Elite operators to view an audio return like any other output, which means it's so much more flexible. Benito is the king of the TriCaster, right, Benito? You understand all this stuff. It's a mystery to me, but our technical directors love it. The all-new Neural Voice Isolation Tool, which cleans audio, uses AI to cancel or reduce background noise, automatically detects voices and says, the rest of it, throw it out. Audio is so important to video. And you know, I love it that the folks at NewTek understand that. You get increased power, flexibility, and simplicity. We use the macros like crazy. Now they support variables, which is really kind of cool. It's like becoming a programming system. The system offers dynamic and powerful tools to allow operators to nest macros to deliver complex productions more easily. You could encode up to three channels all at the same time. They've got the live panel builder now in the TriCaster, meaning users can create bespoke user interfaces, customize the presets within the user interface, making your distributed workflows simpler, more cohesive, without compromising on quality. The NDI Genlock 2, by the way, really is important, and that's a new feature in the TriCaster 2 Elite, which allows you to match outputs to a common sync pulse. Perfect for remote workflows. Operators can now send alpha channel through one of the mix outs. I mean, I can go on and on. It is really an impressive tool. Operators can see the resolution and frame rate of every video source coming into the TriCaster, so you know exactly, before you put it on the air, what you're going to get. Since its arrival in 2020, TriCaster 2 Elite has offered incredibly powerful live production systems to people in every area of video. I know so many churches and schools, broadcasters who use TriCaster. It's transformative. The TriCaster 1 Pro, also an excellent choice for producers, content creators, and publishers. It has Live Call Connect support for 4K UHD streaming, live streaming. It's kind of amazing what we can do these days. There's a whole TriCaster family. The best thing to do, visit the website, go.newtek.com/twit-tv, where you'll find an easy-to-use interactive guide that offers advice on which TriCaster is right for you. That's what got us started many years ago, and it's what keeps us on the air every single day. go.newtek.com/twit-tv. A real tip of the hat to NewTek for that technology. It's been so important for us. Thank you, NewTek. We appreciate it. We were shooting Becky in SD, right? I mean, that wasn't high def even that we were doing Tech TV.
4x3. It was old school.
It's amazing. You know how
the resolution was low, especially that time that you streaked the set of Internet
Thank
Tonight.
Thank goodness. You couldn't see a thing. I was moving far too fast. I think I was.
You were wearing pants. You just had them down very low.
Thank you. Okay.
Had them down very low.
The resolution was low, but the quality was high.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Hey, take a look at some of the things we did this week using our new tech TriCaster. Here's a best of for you.
Why? Well, hey. What are you laughing at?
Well, hey.
It's time for the Tech Guy Show. I thought I'd try something new, but I guess you don't like it.
It felt a little odd. I'll say that.
Yodelay.
Previously on Twit. iOS Today.
Rosemary Orchard is back, and we are talking about taking your devices offline. Yes, there are times when it is time to step away from the Wi-Fi, the cellular data.
All about Android.
A very important date happened for us Android developers back in May 2017. Oh. This week, Google's celebrating it. They've got their hashtag high five calling on Android, and they're just taking time to celebrate and look back on 5 years of having Kotlin be a first-party development language for Android.
This week in Google.
You know, we all know about DALL-E, too. I have this. Should we just do one?
Podcast legend having lunch.
That's good. I like it. Oh, here it is. Podcast legend having lunch.
That's awesome.
AI generated.
I think that's art.
AI generated.
Oh, even better. Yeah. Oh, my God. I love it.
That's what it looks like.
That's awesome.
Look at this one. It looks like me and Joe Rogan having lunch.
I love that.
Did any of you, speaking of Joe Rogan, listen to 3 hours of Joe Rogan interviewing Mark Zuckerberg? Anybody? Show of hands? No. You missed it. You were in the Arctic.
Yeah. Was it great?
I don't know. I didn't listen to it either. I have to go with the summaries published by some of the tech reporters who were willing to sit through 3 hours of it. Among other things, Mark said owning, being in charge of Meta means that he wakes up every morning, it's like being punched in the stomach.
Poor Mark.
Poor Mark.
That sounds like the kind of work experience I want, right?
He says that there's, you know, he'll wake up in the morning and you know, all of the messages that came in overnight, all of the problems that Facebook's facing come rushing back to him. And it's like being punched in the stomach. Then he clarified, by the way, he said, that's not bad. I'm really happy to be one of the wealthiest men in the world. I mean,
the whole interview is basically is that classic Zuckerberg thing of saying lots without saying anything at all.
Yeah.
If you read the I'm gonna be unashamedly British here and pick the BBC summary of the interview.
Good idea.
Zuckerberg said that getting the decision wrong, quote, sucks. When we take something down that we're not supposed to, that's the worst.
So this
and
was something
like,
that.
Oh,
they,
wow! What an incredible insight. Thank you, Mark. And he says, depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, you either think we didn't censor it enough or we censored it way too much. I mean, wow.
Both are right. Both are accurate.
The insight.
These
is
are the
incredible.
Highlights too. I can't imagine
so
the
does
filler
it hurt
words.
To grow a conscience, is that what he said?
This was about the Hunter Biden laptop story that was published in the New York Post, which Facebook and Mark admitted this did push down. They said we didn't block it, but we lowered the temperature on it. And there was some. He mentioned that the FBI had contacted him. The FBI later clarified. They said we are not allowed to, and we did not say to him take down this story. In fact, we didn't even mention the Hunter Biden laptop story. We mentioned that there is misinformation from foreign actors showing up, and you might want to do something about that. We can't tell you what to do. You might want to do something about that.
Also, he talks about, and I just love this because the irony of when you go back to the origins of Facebook is incredible. He talks about how it's difficult to deal with sort of thorny issues around personal lives. And he says, I didn't get into this to basically judge these things.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, didn't you get into this entirely to just judge women based on their appearance in Harvard?
Hot or
Wasn't
not?
That the entire point? You literally got into this to judge things.
I didn't even think of that.
That's a hell of a point.
He also let us know that he's big into mixed martial arts now, jiu-jitsu. The whole family, big into jiu-jitsu.
Is it going to become another body freak like Bezos
know.
Is?
I don't know.
Wow.
All right.
Is he done with the motorized foil?
No.
Surfboard? Is he done with that?
No. Big into that. He plans to do a lot more surfing and foiling.
Okay.
But he does
and
say
jiu-jitsu. And a lot more sun cream.
And a lot more sun cream. He does say jiu-jitsu is, quote, a big part of who I am. Okay, I guess
good.
I didn't miss anything. I literally every day since that interview, I've been getting up saying, you know, I really should listen to the Zuckerberg interview.
And then you just realize he's one of the most powerful yet boring people on
so
Earth.
Boring. So
well,
boring.
Well, he's a boring communicator. He's a boring communicator.
Yes.
And I think it's important to distinguish that you can have a lot of brilliant people or a lot of powerful people who don't express themselves well. And he knows this about himself. I think back to that interview with Kara Swisher where he just sweated his way through it.
Oh, my God. Talk about flop
sweats.
I also
think, Becky, to your point, I don't think it's that he doesn't express himself well. I think he chooses not to express himself.
Yeah, yeah. He may be smart enough.
I think he's a very interesting person, self-censor. But he just doesn't put himself out there.
Yeah. Honestly, it's funny because we began this show bemoaning how expressive Elon Musk is and how much he says. Too much. And now we're talking about Zuck and how little he says. You just can't win with us, I guess.
But Elon probably had a girlfriend before he got rich, which might have made a difference. You know, having some social experience.
Let's correct that. Let's correct that right
here.
Sorry. The Social Network got it wrong. Zuck was with Priscilla Chan before Facebook. He ended up marrying her. He's still with her. They have kids.
Well, kudos to him.
Yeah, no, he had a girlfriend then. That didn't stop him.
She should have done more.
Doing what he was doing.
Look, as somebody whose love life was a disaster before I got rich, I'm just not going to judge either way. Like, come on, guys, give me a break.
California has announced it's banning the sale of new gasoline cars in 2035.
I love this.
I love that. Do you drive an electric vehicle, Ms. Worley?
I sure do.
What do you drive?
I have the Volvo XC40. It's
oh, nice.
Small,
pretty
all
car,
electric.
Though. Love it.
Love it.
Love it.
Not super expensive. I mean, they're all a little bit expensive, and you could get cheaper. Well,
you
but
know what?
It's
our
not
Chevy
like
Bolt, all electric, fancy. $20,000 after.
Okay, that's a good price.
So they aren't that expensive.
Which is half what it was 5 years ago, which
we
is
bought
amazing.
It 2 years ago, and we got the $7,500 tax break, which is now back, but it was gone for a while. And I think there was a state $2,500 tax break. So I think it was $30,000, but after we paid for it, it was ended up being $20,000 in breaks. That's not out of people's reach.
No.
And it's a great EV. I drive a Mustang Mach-E. We gave the Bolt to our son, 19-year-old, and Lisa has an electric Mini. So you think it's a good thing, Becky?
I also want the Ford F-150, but the SUV version. They have the Lightning right now, which I would like to have, but I schlep kids. And so anything to get rid of my mini limo. So sick of my minivan. God.
You know what I want? The VW Buzz.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
that would be good for a little family. Yeah, it's the old VW bus in electric form.
So, yes, I think it's a really good thing. And I go back to the California Air Resources Board changing the world with their emission standards back in the early 2000s when they set the emission standards for California. And as California goes, so goes the country. And hopefully if the country doesn't have the will to do it, California is big enough to have an impact. And so I see this as hugely positive. I know there are... The good news is it's only the obvious thing is it's new electric cars. That's what must be sold in California. And it corresponds with 2035 is when GM says all their cars will be electric. And, that gives time for the infrastructure, the charging infrastructure to come in. And I think people will get much more comfortable with range anxiety and realizing I actually don't drive 300 miles very often. And by then, hopefully you'll have fast charge stations.
Nice. Here's a... Our operations guy in his Ford Lightning with license plate. Howdy, y'all. You could tell he's from Texas. Howdy, here I come in my Lightning.
I want that.
Isn't that nice?
I love a truck. Now, you know what I'm waiting for us to do in California is to ban gas-powered leaf blowers.
Oh, God,
that's
please.
What we need to get
please.
Rid of. And not only is it noise pollution, but a leaf blower has more carbon dioxide emissions, pollutants, than a 2010 F-150.
Yeah, they're still two strokes.
They're two strokes.
Yeah. We all remember two strokes.
What we really need is four stroke leaf blowers.
They make
them. They'd be smoother, they'd be quieter, they'd be more powerful.
They make them, and if you go to the Huntington Library in San Marino,
Hummer leaf blowers.
They have great big lunar backpack sized leaf blowers that go, but they're still gas powered.
I think electric.
So, my question is just to play the other side of the political fence for a minute, which I don't ever live on comfortably. There's still this discussion about the calculus of, okay, here's what it takes to build an electric car. Here's what it takes to manufacture batteries. Here's what it takes to cycle all that stuff out of the ecosystem later. How long do you have to convert to all electric before that plays out into a net win? Or do you? I mean, I've read a bunch of different accounts of this, and I haven't yet seen one that really convinced me one way or the other. Because it's really resource intensive and...
Well, it's tough on the grid.
It's also desperately different depending on where you live.
What is it? So how's EV in the UK? Are people doing EVs?
So EV in UK is interesting. Again, depending on where you live, because in California, you know, or in America generally, like people have houses that have driveways.
Yes.
And that means you can charge, a car on your driveway.
Yeah.
Right. You live in London, you know, 90% of places that you live in London don't have driveways. You park on the street, so you're relying on the government to provide charging infrastructure on the street where you live, which is very difficult. On the other hand, you're probably driving much shorter distances, which is either better or worse, depending on your point of view. I will say that I think I was in Brighton, which is twinned with Santa Monica in the States. So that gives you an idea of what kind of place it is. And this weekend, they had a... do you guys know Vespas, the little Italian scooters that were kind of like the mod culture of the 60s?
Always wanted one of those, yeah.
So they had a little mod festival, and it was, and there were hundreds of these bikes all along the coastline of Brighton Beach.
Mods.
I was there. Yeah, the mods and rockers. And I was there, and I was thinking, what is, you know... The mods were the 70s. We're in the 20s. In the 2070s, what is going to be the equivalent of the mods on their Vespas now? Is it going to be anybody driving a gas-powered car? Is it going to be... You know,
Arnold in his Hummer?
What are we going to have nostalgia for in 50 years where we think, actually, that's probably not very good for the environment, but it's quite cute at the moment?
Remember when you could go outside without having your hair burn off?
And I would say, so my point of view is I love cars, and I love, you know, unlike Americans, the British have some history. So we have nice cars backfill.
Poo-poo
so,
to you.
Yeah, sorry. So I have a lovely little 1970s sports car.
I'm jealous.
But
do you have an MG, a Triumph? What do you have?
Yeah. It's a little 1970 MG drop top.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
That was the very end of the era for those.
Yeah,
as the flip side to
how
that.
How Austin I'm Powers turning, of you.
Very Austin Powers. But because I'm turning 40 next week and I have a,
happy birthday.
A midlife crisis, I've bought an electric motorbike.
Perfect.
And it's like, if you're in London...
That's a perfect choice.
And all you want to do is 40... You know, range anxiety, the range on this thing is 40 miles. But in London, that's about, you know, 4 weeks of riding. So I've bought there's a great brand called Maving, MAEVING.com. And they make very classically British inspired sort of Triumph. It's all Triumph engineers.
So it doesn't work,
electric bikes.
Burst into flames? Is that?
Hey, excuse me. I had an Austin Healey. Wait a minute.
This is not a bicycle. This is a motorcycle.
Electric.
No. It's a motorbike.
Yeah.
That as a little commuter villa around London, and obviously, you know, it's not going to be amazing in LA or Petaluma, but you scoot around New York or any sort of urban area in that, and it's going to be fantastic.
What's the top speed on this?
It does about 60.
That's beautiful.
And how much is it?
About five UK pounds.
£5?
About 6,500. Yeah.
Okay. You left off a couple zeros there. I was getting excited.
Well, it's only £5, Gavin.
It's not bad, though. And where's it made?
Especially right now with the dollar so strong.
Yeah. Where's it made?
Well, exactly. So it's kind of like, well, what is going to be the equivalent of, you know, we're looking at all these electric things, and it's great, but what is going to be the equivalent in 20 or 30 years' time of driving around a vintage car? Is it going to be, are we going to have a newfound nostalgia for Hummers?
You look like Lawrence of Arabia riding this around. That's fantastic.
Steve McQueen, I'm going for, Leo.
Oh,
Steve
all right.
McQueen.
Okay, yeah, probably better. This is so cute. I'm actually, I wonder if I can get this in the U.S. I'm tempted. But you've ordered it, or are you just looking at it?
Yeah. It's coming a week after my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. What a perfect thing.
Okay, can I just
in time for my midlife crisis.
Yeah, there you go. That and your Triumph, you're set. Maving. It's great. Right around. You're just like a mod rocker.
Maver, hardly you.
Oh,
Is that a stirrup? Do you put your foot in that thing?
Yeah, sure. It's like a horse. Jack Dorsey says, my biggest regret is that I turned Twitter into a company.
So does he mean like it could have been like Craigslist and he could have been like Craig?
Yeah. Somebody asked him on Twitter, Jack, wondering what was your intent on Twitter and has it turned out the way you wanted it? See, it feels a bit skewed leftward right now. How do we straighten it? It seems an inordinate amount of rightward-leaning Twitter users are being banned or kicked off. Well, this guy obviously has an agenda. It can't be good for MDAO. The biggest issue and my biggest regret is that it became a company. I think what he meant, and it's interesting to read the replies, is I wish it had been a protocol. And Kevin Marks says, well, I might point out we were treating it as a protocol because you had an API right up until Chirp when Twitter rug pulled that, killed all third-party clients and most apps. Yeah. Oh, I remember that. The Twitter winter. So
I mean, it's really good for Jack to talk about, oh, I really wish I'd made it open. I really wish I'd done this and that and the other. And it's like, dude, A, you made an absolute shoot ton of money. So it's very easy to look back and say, I wish I'd done it a different way from a perspective of immense privilege and immense money. And B, at every point you had the opportunity to make Twitter open, you repeatedly chose to not do that. You bought TweetDeck, bought, you know, every single thing that was successful, you killed it all off. So, I mean, sure, have regrets, but it's very hard to have regrets over things that you consciously, repeatedly chose to do. It's like, maybe I have regret over this one thing that I did once occasionally, but if you keep doing something, can you really regret it? It's more like, well, at that point, you kind of made a life choice.
You could say I was a jerk.
Like the five times that I shut down every client and every API and I rate limited everything that accessed Twitter and I refused to build a decent desktop client and I refused to build a mobile app that had, I mean, how Maybe much he's regret learned his do lesson. You really have?
Maybe he's learned his lesson.
Well, a few billion dollars will give everyone perspective, right?
Here is a final story that I think has a happy ending. A Unix legend, Brian Kernahan, who was instrumental in writing Unix. I have his book, The C Programming Language. Brilliant guy, Princeton professor. He's now 80 years old. He realized that the awk program that he wrote that is widely used on Unix-like platforms didn't support Unicode, so he wrote it. He added, and because he says, I don't really understand Git, I'm just going to email you. I'm going to email you the code. Unicode support for awk at the age of 80. I've tested this a fair amount. It clearly needs more tests. He wrote an email to the One True Awk repo posted by longtime maintainer Arnold Robbins. Once I figure out how, I will try to submit a pull request. I wish I understood Git better, but in spite of your help, I still don't have a proper understanding. So this may take a while. It made me pull out my old C programming language book, which I got in 1982, and realized that was Kernahan was 40 back then, and I was a mere sprout of 25. But it's a beautiful
story. What a legend.
Kernahan, yes.
Just absolute legend.
Yeah, and a wonderful story. Wonderful story.
And a real example of how we can really venerate all the sort of, you know, incredible Web3 entrepreneurs and all the, you know, the incredible sort of people that are doing the new, but how we're all standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
And that sort of, you know, that generation of early computer scientists and engineers are hitting that, you know, golden age.
Yeah.
And we're gonna see them in their retirement. You know, the service corps of retired executives is now the service corps of retired engineers or something.
Well,
of
his co-author on the C programming language passed several years ago, Richie. And that was a big deal when he passed. Because, yeah, we've realized it for some time that we've walked amongst legends like Becky Worley. And I will be telling such stories about you.
I'm not a legend yet.
I'm pinky
working
into
on
space.
My legendariness. There you go. Hey, I have two quick updates. I know you're trying to wrap this, but MIT says when it comes to clean technologies like electric cars, even the dirtiest batteries emit less CO2 than using no battery at all. So that's that's the answer to Rod's question. And during this show, Elon Musk tweeted, Godspeed Artemis. So as we look forward to the week and the possible launch, let's just keep our fingers crossed.
We didn't really talk about that, but that's tomorrow morning at 5:30 Pacific, 8:30 Eastern. Pacific, if it goes off, you know, it's...
Turn it on in the background, and if you don't hear a countdown hold at 30 seconds, you can probably assume it's going to go.
The NASA stream is in 4K on YouTube. If you have access to a 4K set, that will be worth watching. It is unmanned. There's only a mannequin aboard, Munikin Campos, who is named after Campos was Capcom, right? Or I can't. He was astronaut. So. Yeah,
this is NASA trying to popularize things better.
And Munikin because
Munikin just hurts.
Why not? He'll be sitting in the command seat. So you'll see him.
With a speaker in his mouth talking to the Amazon Alexa system.
Yeah, apparently they got some money from Jeff Bezos. Yeah. And from, it turns out, Cisco WebEx. Cisco and Amazon partnered to do a test of the Amazon Echo in space because astronauts really need to be able to talk to the spacecraft. I can remember one time that didn't work so well.
Hal.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Well.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
And do they really have to now? I, as she said, I know you're trying to wrap up, but there's so much available on glass panel controls. You know, it's not the push buttons and toggle switches of the Apollo and shuttle era. Do they really need that? I mean, I guess it could be handy, especially if you're on a spacewalk.
They need it because they needed the money from Amazon.
I need more electrical wiring cable.
I'm glad you like Motley Crue. I'll be happy to play this song for you. You know,
tell
you
me
know.
A joke.
Yeah. Arturo Campos was a NASA electrical power subsystem manager who was called upon, Houston, we have a problem with Apollo 13 and helped get Apollo 13 safely back to Earth. So I think a very appropriate tribute to he probably wouldn't be thrilled to know that the first name Munikin, but but there you go. It is wearing the Orion Crew survival suit system.
Yeah.
There you go. Nice.
Because they don't have an EVA suit yet.
Yeah. Looks like they're bringing a child mannequin along. I don't know what that's all about, but okay.
Well, this will be the first woman to go to the moon, so maybe it's a smaller person.
Oh, maybe that's the lady.
Might be.
Although two of the ladies are rugby players who could snap you in half.
Yeah, so that's exciting.
I don't feel like they need any compensation.
This
they feel
mission.
Like they'd be quite competent filling
what
out.
I'm
this
saying.
Is the first of three Artemis missions. The first one will go actually 40,000 miles past the moon and then come back.
So this is a really long, because it's uncrewed, they're going out for about 40 days.
Yeah.
So they're going in this really weird big halo orbit. So it's different orbit than any of the Apollo missions used. And it's to accommodate, you know, part of what's wrong with Artemis, if I may, is that the upper stage is so underpowered that even though the main part of the rocket is more powerful than Saturn V, it doesn't have the lifting capability of the moon the Saturn V had, which is why we have all this, you know, we got to meet Elon's rocket out in lunar orbit to get people down the surface. So it's a very, right now, the physics of this are really weird. Basically, they're going to, so this is the first uncrewed one. Next one will be a loop around the moon mission like Apollo 8. And then the third one, Artemis 3, which will happen in 2025, maybe 7, somewhere in there, will carry the first three people, which is when we get, you know, the first woman and first person of color to the moon. But by law, you have to launch them on the SLS, which is the big government rocket. God bless them. I hope it works. In an Orion capsule, which is a third bigger than the Apollo capsule, three people. You got to go to lunar parking orbit, where you meet up with Elon Musk's lunar starship, and then two of those three get in the nose of the starship, taking up about 3% of its total volume with this enormous chasm of an RV behind them and land it tail first on the moon. So it's a little weird.
It's but what this Will is the would first call step. A dog's breakfast of a launch.
A month.
Well,
lunch.
We know what dogs eat. So, yeah, that's
Snoopy will be going along for the ride. Three mannequins, toys, and an Amazon Echo.
And an iPad. And an iPad. I thought the iPad was the one talking to the Echo. What's the iPad up there for?
I'm not sure. I
thought. Wait, if we got Siri talking to Alexa, is that what we're saying?
That would be very interesting. Yeah. Yeah,
but maybe they ended up mounting the iPad there. But, I mean, God bless them. They've been working on this rocket since 2002 in one form or another. And, you know, it's supposed to be easy because it's recycled shuttle parts. So we know they're going to fly it at least four times because they have that many shuttle engines. They got 16 of them sitting around a warehouse.
So they have to use them up?
Well, yeah.
That's Congress.
That's how we're saving money at $4 billion a launch with a B. Lord. Yeah. And then, you know, we'll see what happens after that. But, you know, it's good to have a moon rocket. Elon could wake up one morning and say, this space stuff is for the birds. I don't want to do it anymore. So it's good to have a government program. So more power to him.
It is an Elon touch. You know, they've in the past on Elon launches had a zero gravity indicator.
Right,
which
right.
is like a puppet or something floating around. This time it'll be Snoopy.
Yeah.
This will be a Snoopy in a space suit floating around. That'll be the, quote, zero gravity indicator.
Maybe next time Elon will carry something from the new, what is it, House of Dragons? Is that what you said this new show is?
Yeah. Oh, and just as a sop to Will, Shaun the Sheep will be aboard.
Aww.
That's the contribution of the European Space Agency, ESA, and I'm not joking. He's wearing an ESA. He's from Wallace and Gromit. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Should be a lot of fun. There's also a bunch of Apollo 11 crap.
Hey!
They're sticking in there. They're getting it all in, baby. Look, here's a bolt from the Apollo 11 F1 engine that will be flying on Artemis. Wouldn't it be ironic if, like, the Artemis 1 broke, Moonikin came to life and repaired it with the bolt from Apollo's F1 engine.
Following instructions from Amazon.
From Amazon's Echo.
Echo, sorry.
Yeah.
I said the word.
Yeah, it's okay. All right.
Bolt to the right, you idiot.
I'm glad. I forgot. We completely forgot. That's the whole reason you're here, Rod Pyle. So thank you.
That's you.
Oh, and can I add one quick thing?
Yeah.
September 26th, the DART mission reaches Didymos. And the DART mission is a double asteroid redirect test. This is NASA's little heralded test to slam a spacecraft into an asteroid to see if we actually can knock them off course should they be on their way to Earth to take out a major city.
Kind of important. Bigger.
So it's a very small rock, but it's a valid test. And if the physics of it work out as they plan, then we start building bigger ones and we'll protect ourselves, we hope, in the event this should ever occur. And the Chinese, true to form, have decided they're going to run their own mission with the same general design in about 2 years using technology that looks hauntingly like ours.
And this is the stuff you learn on This Week in Space.
On This Week in Space.
On Twit, on the Twit Network, Rod and Tara Malik. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Rod Pyle, space.nss.org. If you want to subscribe to Ad Astra, look for his books in the bookstore. Becky Worley, what are you working on for ABC? Anything exciting besides the sleep study thing?
I have a lot of tech stuff going on, Apple stuff, and then waterproof mascara.
Awesome.
I've been looking for that for years.
Me too.
I know.
Because I cry a lot on camera. Tammy Faye would have loved this.
Yeah, I did magnetic eyelashes couple months ago.
How do you like those?
This is an outcropping. They're incredible technology and a great innovation.
Do they snap onto your eyelid or something?
Yeah.
You use a metallic eyeliner and then you snap the lashes onto it. And we did an open-top bus going across the Golden Gate Bridge to test if they made it or not. And two of the eight lashes went. But six lashes holding on is pretty damn good.
You have a cooler life than me.
And now, unfortunately, Becky has been labeled the eyelash reporter. And anytime there is an eyelash product, Worley gets it. I love you, Becky. It's so great to see you.
I love spending time with you.
Congratulations on the kids. On everything, it's going great for you on ABC. Always a pleasure.
And love to Lisa.
Thank you.
And the crew.
Come see us sometime soon.
I would. I'd love to.
Good. Will Harris, I'm going to see you because you're in jolly old England, and I love London, where it is the middle of the night. Go wander on down to the Greenwich Observatory and just check and see for us, will you?
I'll just check what time it is right now. I'll jump out of the apartment and just run down and check.
He's apparently 100 yards away from the Greenwich Meridian.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're very close. So I can tell you that it is, although you say that, I never really believe in the concept of anything other than Apple time. I mean, the time is just what the Apple servers tell me it is on whatever device I happen to be looking at.
Fair enough.
I mean, the Greenwich Meridian could be hours out, but if Apple tells me it's 1:40, it's 1:40.
Oh, well, but at least at 100 meters away, your MG might make it. So there's something to be said for that.
You only need one tune-up on
the
way.
British manufacturing energy.
It's not that. It's the
like
coil
it.
On cars that came from the rainiest country on earth that don't run in the rain.
Yeah, no, you don't want to take that car out in the rain.
I'm jealous. What a great car. I'm so jealous. Thank you, Will. It's great to see you. Unbound.com, 42, the Douglas Adams book. All sorts of great stuff. You're doing really interesting
cool
publishing.
Idea.
I love
some
this.
Really great geeky books. Yeah. Loads of stuff that you're going to love. We've got an entire book on the butts of characters in video games. That's all about, starts with the concept of Mario's butt. How did you invent Mario's butt? It's a great question.
Is that butt?
So no, I think so anybody that wants to.
We almost got all the way through without talking about Mario's bottom.
Without any buts. Well, I thought I'd save you at the end. So, yeah, if anybody wants to go to unbound.com, twit15 will get you 15% off a nice little book. So, enjoy Mario's butt.
Oh, God.
Well, from all the other threadbare authors I know, thank you very much for what you're doing.
Yes, I agree.
Please burn down Amazon Publishing for me.
I agree.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You guys rock. You put up with the longest show we've ever done. Honest to God, Patrick Delahanty will tell me, but at 3 hours and 12 minutes, I think it's the longest show we've ever done. You deserve a break. Sorry, you're apologizing to me. I'm the one who kept you. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Good night, Will.
Thank you, Leo. Bye, guys.
What's he doing? He's miming something.
I'm waiting for the another twit is.
Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye, everybody. I won't keep you around much longer.
This is amazing.